Okay, let's, if we could get everybody together, we're right at 12:30 and we'll go ahead and get our meeting started. And we'll, first off, we'll start around the room. Welcome everybody, glad to have you all here. We'll do introductions around the room first and then we'll find out who's on the phone. So Representative Helm, let's start with you, do the around the room introductions.
Hi, Representative Ken Helm, House District 34, Beaverton, Cedar Hills.
Senator Doug Whitsett, Senate District 28, Klamath Lake, Deschutes, Crook, and part of Jackson County.
Scott Welch, Columbia Sportswear.
Kenji Sugihara, Executive Director, Oregon Bicycle Racing Association, and Oregon Tourism Commission member.
Mike Herbel, Neskwin, Oregon, Sport Fishing Representative.
James Nash, Sixth Ranch.
Chris Edwards, State Senator representing Eugene and Junction City.
Paul Don Hefner, Oregon Hunters Association.
And I'm Mark Labhart, and I'm Tillamook County Commissioner representing the Association of Oregon Counties.
Rob Ball, Nature Conservancy.
Retired Executive Director for the Audubon Society of Portland.
Claire Pucci, retired in various places.
Bruce Taylor, one of the conservation representatives.
Jim Martin, representing the sport fishing industry.
I'm Beth Petrino, Legislative Committee staff.
And Brett Browns, come with Governor Brown's office.
Roger Furman, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Jim Owens, facilitator. Okay. Joe, start with you in the back.
I'm Joe Rollayer.
I'm David Rocker with the Oregon Beverage.
Welcome.
David Shepherdson representing the Oregon Zoo and the Oregon Chapter of the Wildlife.
Ned Jones representing the Wildlife in Oregon.
Dave Fox with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Kevin with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Jeff Samuels, Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division.
Meg Mitchell with the U.S. Forest Service.
Great. And on the phone, who do we have on the phone?
Mike Finley, Chair of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Welcome, sir. Anybody else? Okay, so rather than starting off with a joke from Jim, we could have, Claire just got back from Mongolia, and so night is day and day is night for her, so just keeping her awake will be a, probably an issue, and Brett just got back from the Eagle Caps with llamas, so he could probably tell you a story about packing with llamas and an eight-year-old.
I can prepare.
So glad to have you both here. So do you have a joke?
Not after that.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and move right on. You have your agenda in front of you. I just want to cover the meeting objectives today. We have four objectives. Complete the preliminary work group recommendations. We'll have a report on that. Receive input from the Legislative Council Office and the Oregon Beverage Redemption Cooperative on funding scenarios. We'll have a little presentation from both of those folks. Review the work group recommendations and seek agreement on funding objectives, funding scenarios, and other aspects of the work group assignments. And then talk about our next steps in developing the recommendations for the target outreach. So we've invited two presentations about the funding scenarios, and we'll get to that in a little bit. We'll then hear from the two work groups and discuss their recommendations, and we'll use the remainder of the meeting assessing the progress we've made and defining our next steps, and hopefully we'll be done around 4 o'clock. So we have a little bit of housekeeping items about the supporting materials and those things. Jim, turn it over to you for housekeeping.
So good afternoon. Consider me your summer reading resource. If at any time you find yourself sitting on a beach without something to read, I have failed. So we sent out a variety of materials. Among those was a news release on the bottle bill increase. We sent out a press release on the blue ribbon legislation. A variety of communications over the last month, which included a ODF&W report on their tribal partnerships. And then we just handed out a thing called Proposed General Approach to Outreach, and this will be something we discuss later in the agenda. But before you leave today, we're hoping that you'll help fill in these blanks. And I think that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I have two items just to report to the group. We've been asked by the Fish and Wildlife Commission to come in and give them a status report. So on August 5th, Jim and I will be reporting our status to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission. That's August 5th, and I think we're on at 8 o'clock. Is that correct, Mike or Roger?
Yeah,
8 o'clock. So if you'd like to attend that or call in and listen, you're most welcome to. We'll be just giving a status report of our work up to this point in time. And then also today, I'd like to have a discussion a little bit later this morning about the National Blue Ribbon Committee recommendations and whether we as a task force want to make a recommendation or propose a letter. So be thinking about that. So now I'd like to just go around the room and see if there's any report from any of the task force members that you might have following conversations with your constituencies or anything that you'd like the rest of the task force to hear about. Is there anybody that would like to provide any input to us from discussions with your constituency groups on anything related to this task force? Okay, seeing none, we'll move right into actions and then on the recommendations of the Blue Ribbon panel. So we've received emails and handouts regarding the National Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies Blue Ribbon panel. We had a presentation on that several months ago. The panel has submitted their recommendations. There is a bill being dropped in Congress to carry this forward. And so I'd like to have a discussion. They are asking for endorsements of that legislation. So we've got a couple different options, and maybe there's even more. One is, do we want to weigh in on that and provide a letter of support? Do we want to provide a recommendation to the Fish and Wildlife Commission from our legislative task force asking them to weigh in support of that legislation, or do we not want to do anything with that? So, discussion?
Sure. If I can just give an update, I was at a meeting where they did discuss that. They do have, they have dropped the bill, and they have co-sponsors. They're looking for additional co-sponsors. What they would appreciate groups doing is, and they put this a call out to many, many groups, including different commissions and others, to reach out to their congressional delegation and ask them to sign on as co-sponsors for this bill. Their intent is to run the bill this year, basically to start the discussion. They have enough co-sponsors, and then it queues it up for early discussion and the early consideration early in the next congressional session. So that's their hope, is to get people to reach out to their congressional delegations.
Okay, Bruce?
And maybe this is a question for Beth. Do task forces like this commonly do things like that?
That's a good question. Not in my experience, but I haven't reached out to other staff to ask that question.
I'd be quite comfortable in urging the Fish and Wildlife Commission, which has a little bit more permanent status, to do something like that.
Meryl?
Yeah, I agree. I don't see the downside if we ask the commission to support the bill.
I have some reservations about the bill that I expressed once before. I'm particularly concerned about the impact of the bill on the Land and Water Conservation Fund, and notwithstanding the fact that the presenters said the intent was not to affect it, it's an underfunded fund, if you will, and I think this bill will compete with the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Our senators have worked hard to fund that. I've supported both of them in that effort, and so I have some reservations about this being a zero-based funding proposal, and I think I'd prefer to see the commission address this.
Anybody else want to weigh in? So if I'm hearing us correct, we would, or I would, on August 5th, ask the Fish and Wildlife Commission to weigh in on the bill. And given what Rob just said, should I weigh in support, asking them in support of the bill, or then that there, we're not unanimous on it, that we do have a consensus for support? No.
Yes. See. Support.
Okay.
Support.
Bruce? Okay. Claire?
But also perhaps with the caveat that we don't want to see funding for Lynn Water Conservation efforts.
Okay. So no negative impact to the other funds. Paul, you were okay. Senator, any thoughts?
Which one? I'm not a voting member.
Just want your opinion.
Which one are we on?
Whether we should weigh in with the Fish and Wildlife Commission to ask them to support the federal legislation for the Blue Ribbon Panel.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. James?
I'm in favor.
Okay. Mike?
Yeah.
Kenji? Yeah. Green card, yeah. Scott? Okay. Senator, any thoughts? Okay. Representative? Okay. So I will weigh in support of that then. With the caveats. So next is approval of our June 30th minutes. You should all have a copy of those. Again, Alicia, thank you for your good work on the minutes. Is there consensus? Any corrections or additions? Okay, seeing none, I'll assume that the minutes are approved as submitted. Now we're ready to go to input on funding scenarios. So let's invite Kate. Are you here, Kate? Ah, there you are. If I get the name correct, is it Toswell?
Toswell.
Okay. Kate Toswell is with the Legislative Council's office. We've got a, you should have all received this document here. And if you'll turn over to the second page where it talks about the income tax surcharge, we've asked for some additional information that Beth was able to get to Legislative Council, and they're ready to provide that additional information to us. So, do you want to introduce this? Anything else, Beth, to introduce that?
No, not much, except to say that I had a conversation last week with Kate and with the Legislative Revenue Office staff about this idea. And in talking through the different alternatives, Kate had a number of issues that she raised. I think it's important that all of you hear, depending on the alternative you select, there may be issues that need to be addressed. So.
I'm just wondering if you have a copy of that.
I do, yeah.
And Kate, if you could speak in right into the mic so we can all hear you real clearly, I would appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the task force. I'm Kate Toswell, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel from the Office of Legislative Counsel. And my understanding is that we are going to look at a couple of different potential funding mechanisms. And as Beth Petrino had indicated, we talked last week about some of the potential pitfalls in those mechanisms. The first thing I was going to look at was the idea of adding a surcharge, a flat fee surcharge, to the Oregon resident income tax form. And for the sake of discussion, imagine that it's a $50 or $20 flat surcharge that is added to the tax return, and that it would be paid by each filer of a personal income tax return. And that potentially would be something that people might mount a challenge as being unconstitutional as a head tax or a poll tax. And actually, if my understanding is that this mechanism would have exemptions based on ability to pay, I think it probably actually would pass constitutional muster. There's a recent case which addressed, in the Oregon Court of Appeals, that addressed the arts tax in Multnomah County, which I believe is $35 per person. So on a single return, it would be $35. On a joint return, it would be $70. And there were taxpayers who challenged that and argued that under...
That was the phone.
Okay. Under Article 9, Section 1A of the Oregon Constitution, which prohibits poll taxes or head taxes, that should be invalidated. And in looking at that provision, the recent Multnomah County or City of Portland arts tax, the Court of Appeals said that this is not actually a poll tax that would be invalid. And not because the argument that the City of Portland made, which was that it was actually an income tax because it applied to income and had exemptions for certain amounts of income and certain types of income. For example, retirement income, if all of the taxpayers' taxable income on their Oregon State tax return was retirement income, they would have an exemption. They would not be required to pay the $35 arts tax. The court didn't believe that it was an income tax, even though it was measured, in a sense, by income. But they said that because of the exemptions for people of limited means, it was acceptable. And in doing that, they looked at the legislative, or in fact, the equivalent of legislative history, but the intent of the voters who put that provision into the Oregon Constitution at the beginning of the 20th century. And when Article 9, Section 1A was added to the Constitution, the ban on poll taxes or head taxes, the materials that the voters considered and the discussion around that said essentially, this is a question of fairness and it is not fair. It's not appropriate for there to be a flat tax that applies to all equally. Somebody who makes many hundreds or thousands of times the income as, say, a laborer, for them to pay the same amount. This is the problem that we are seeking to redress. And looking at that, the Oregon Court of Appeals said, because there's an exemption, we don't view this as the type of head or poll tax that constitutional provision would prevent. Also interestingly, in that case, they said, even though the term is poll tax, it's actually not connected to voting. Poll is essentially a synonym for head. And the idea of having a per capita tax that applies to everyone, all taxpayers, regardless of ability to pay, is seen as violating the Oregon Constitution, that one provision. And that case is extremely recent. That was in June of this year that we got some more guidance from the Oregon Court of Appeals about what that provision means. And essentially, if you do have a flat type of tax that applies on the on all tax returns, if there are those safeguards of having exemptions based on means, based on ability to pay, it would be constitutionally valid. That doesn't actually end the discussion. One thing we look at, even as we start this discussion, is whether it in fact is a tax or a fee. This is a question that we consider frequently. And in looking at this, if it were paid by all taxpayers, everyone filing an Oregon tax return, and if there was no sign of an equal benefit in return, our office generally would say this has the markings of a tax rather than a fee. It's not something where you can elect not to pay it and not get the benefit in return. For example, a licensing fee where you can forego a benefit, avoid paying the fee, and go about your business. This is something where you would have to pay and wouldn't necessarily get a direct benefit, and in fact, where the proceeds would go to general government goods. So already we would view it as a tax, and it would have the accompanying requirements of a supermajority if it were enacted. And beyond that, there's also the question of its place on the Oregon income tax returns, in that there are non-residents, out-of-state filers who are required to pay Oregon income tax and who are required to file. And they're required to file based on income that is derived from Oregon. And that has been upheld as long as it's apportioned appropriately. So in other words, there's a ratio. And if only a portion of their income is derived from this state, or if it's derived from both within and without Oregon, there's a ratio that's used. So they wouldn't be taxed on all of their income. They would be taxed proportionately. And that is a provision that's in the Oregon statutes and that has been upheld by Oregon courts. So that is one concern, where if you had a $50 fee and you required all Oregon taxpayers, including the non-residents and the part-year filers, so people who've moved out of state, to pay that, that would potentially be a problem. That would potentially be a problem under the Commerce Clause, which prohibits discrimination against interstate commerce, and potentially also under the Privileges and Immunities Clause. It would need to be apportioned in some way, and by doing that, it would no longer be, well, it wouldn't be a flat tax in that case. So sort of in summary, doesn't necessarily look like this would be a head or poll tax, but it might run into some other constitutional issues, both under the U.S. Constitution and under the Oregon Constitution.
Okay, questions, comments for Kate?
If it was able to be done, could you limit how many people could attach fees to a tax return, or would that make it wide open for any entity to attach their own fee?
Oh, in terms of if this were appropriate than others, I think the analysis would be the same. I mean, I think that's more a political question. I know that there are some practical questions as to the amount of space that's on the return and the administration of any additional type of tax or fee. But I think the analysis, that's a separate analysis.
Okay, Bruce and then Kenji.
Yes, on the non-resident filings, is that something that is normally addressed in legislation, or is that the Department of Revenue makes an interpretation as to how to deal with that on the tax return? Or
I believe that is something that would need to be addressed in legislation. And as far as the existing taxes, there are already statutes that provide for apportionment, both for personal and corporate income taxpayers who have a business income or who have personal income both within and without the state. And I believe it would have to be a statute that provided for that.
Okay.
So legislatively.
Kenji?
So is there any possibility that the Whittemeyer case might be appealed, or is it done now? Is it outside the timeline?
It could still be appealed. And as of now, there's no subsequent judicial history. But yes, it was the Oregon Court of Appeals, so potentially the Oregon Supreme Court could take that up. And it was June of this year, so it's very recent.
Jim?
So if I understood correctly, you said that it's a tax if there's no benefit in return. Would an exemption for hunting and fishing license holders represent a benefit? Pass that test.
I'm not sure that is the same. It is part of the test that it's closer. There's, I believe, a continuum or a spectrum. It's closer to being a tax if you can't point to an equal benefit in return, and you also can't elect not to pay. And it's more like a tax if it if the proceeds are directed to general government good as opposed to something that's specific. But I think by having the exemption, in a way, then only the people who are not getting the license, I mean, it means that there's no double counting. There isn't double taxation for those people, but it doesn't necessarily avoid taxing the people who are not getting licenses. Which actually raises another question with the out-of-state residents, where it's not clear that they're getting a benefit. They're being taxed. Part of the Commerce Clause analysis is whether the taxing activity, there's a nexus between the taxpayer and the activity within the state. And if the person is not a resident, there's that concern as well.
Anybody else? So would it be best, Kate, with your advice that you've given us orally, to make a written request of this is going to be, at least for one of the task forces, this is going to be a recommendation for further discussion from the task force, it appears. So given what you've just told us that, yeah, it's there's some issues here and there. If we did that, if we made that request in writing and said, here's specifically what we're thinking about doing, we need a written answer whether this can move forward in a legislative concept or not. Would you be able to provide that so we have it? Because we don't want to do something that ends up being, well, no, you can't do it, and here's the reasons why. Because I've heard, you know, some caveats given that kind of leading toward, well, but if you did it this way, it might work, but if you got to be careful because of this. And so is there a way that we can put that in writing so we can get either a yes or a no, that this is okay, or no, it's not, you have to modify it or do this, so we have something to give to the legislature if the group decides to make that recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I would observe that often with these questions, they are very factually sensitive, factually dense, and that often turn on the both when our office is looking at a legal question,
sure,
or when another law firm, or when a court is, the specific facts of the parties or of the particular fact pattern often are very significant. And with any of this, it's true that actual details are something we'd look at closely, because then if we're researching it, there may be some specific thing that a particular case has turned on that has made a significant difference.
Yeah.
So that may in fact be.
Okay, because it seems like we don't want to go down a path of, if the task force says, yes, this is a path we want to go down, and we get down the path and all of a sudden it goes, nope, you can't do that, and we've wasted all that time. So it seems like we need to get that pretty firmed up of exactly what we're going to propose. Is that everybody in the?
Yes.
And get a yes or a no on this. Senator?
Thank you, Mark. Kate, did LCA analyze this as a percentage of taxable income as opposed to a surcharge? Would it materially change your conclusions?
I think we have not explored this as fully as we have liked. Certainly, if it's a percentage, then you do not you can stay completely away from the idea that it would be this potentially a poll tax, a flat amount that all are paying. Potentially removing those of limited means, but still having it be flattened across the board. If it's a percentage, you move away from those concerns. I don't know if it the issue of the non-residents, the part-year filers, that would affect it as well. That's something I'd want to explore further. They're clearly distinguishable, I would say.
Mark, I have a question.
Sure. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife has a non-game responsibility, which I know you're aware of. It's more of a stewardship heritage for Oregonians not yet born. It's not related to the actual taking of fish and wildlife, but maintaining Oregon's wildlife, its habitat for future Oregonians. And I guess I'm curious how you would respond to how that is framed in a way that it does address benefits to all Oregonians. I don't know the constitutional issues that you're talking about on commerce, but these deer herds and many of these fisheries cross state boundaries. And so if the tax question is, Washington State people living in Vancouver paying Oregon tax, or it's or Yreka Californians working in Southern Oregon. There are cross-boundary benefits between states by maintaining proper habitat and wildlife resources. So I'd just like you to maybe respond to that without a lot of research.
Right, that actually sounds like that is an interesting factor here. I mean, the cases talk about interstate commerce in a way that's clearly interstate commerce, but it's usually people who are in trucks or trains or what have you. The idea of the Commerce Clause being not to divide up the states into separate little entities, but to allow the free flowing of commerce, and to the idea that the wildlife is now moving, which of course it will, that's a spin that we'd have to look at. I mean, that is definitely a factor that I don't know that it's in most Commerce Clause analysis. And there are many cases that consider this, but it's often about rail transport or people sending catalogs into other states. But yes, that is something we definitely want to think about and talk about further before making an assessment.
That's one thing, Mark, I'd like to see us emphasize in our write-up is the multiple generation responsibility of the agency to protect Oregon's fish and wildlife, call it watchable wildlife, whatever you want, for future Oregonians that are not yet at the table. The stewardship responsibility to maintain that for future generations. And that really doesn't focus specifically on the taking of fish and wildlife.
Okay, thanks. Merrill?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could speak a little bit to the administrative costs and the infrastructure that might entail, that you would have to set up for something like this if we went forward.
That, I would probably have to defer on that. I'm more the legal analysis. I mean, I assume there would be costs, but again, that's not something that our office would necessarily deal with.
Okay.
It's possible that the
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm Christine Broniak. I'm from the Legislative Revenue Office. I'm an economist, and I didn't want to totally speak for DOR, but they do have a new computer system. It might be possible to program in some sort of surcharge into that system. It's really uncertain how much it would actually cost, but there would be probably some type of programming cost for that. There's already a structure in place to collect taxes and to calculate them, and so it would just be some sort of add-on to that. Wouldn't imagine it would be ongoing. It probably would be a one-time type of startup cost.
Okay. So, yeah, Brad?
Kate and Christine, thanks for being willing to come and speak. So on the fee versus a tax question, how does if we're not looking at just a municipal geography or jurisdiction, and we're looking statewide at something as this task force seems to be, and the benefits are, framed in context of outdoor recreation, conservation, wildlife conservation, habitat conservation, education. And how specific does the nexus between the benefit and the funding source need to be to qualify it as a fee versus tax, given that we're looking statewide? It's hard to just zero in on one specific thing.
I would say actually, a couple of things. Looking at it statewide in some ways makes it look more like a tax than a fee. It's more across the board. It potentially also raises questions around uniformity. That's maybe a discussion for another day. All of these things fit together, though. And if you look, when you look at the cases, and there's a continuum where some things are clearly you're paying for a particular benefit that can be identified.
As laid out of here's a program fork that would be implemented with
you
this.
Go and pay for a certain license. You can go to the park and pay a park license fee for the day,
you could choose not to do that. You're getting a benefit in return, and it looks as though the benefit is commensurate with what you're paying. And then there are other cases or maybe analytical frameworks where you're looking at something like a courthouse. There have been issues recently about funding of courthouses where there are fees or surcharges that are added on to filing fees. And it's not clear, I mean, you're getting the benefit of having a courthouse. You're also getting the benefit of having a court system that works, even if you're not yourself using it on a particular day or for a particular case. And along that spectrum, I think there are factual distinctions. So I don't know that, I mean, if it's across the state, it maybe makes it look a little bit more like a tax. It's closer to a general government good, but then maybe it is it's enough of a benefit that you're getting in return, and it's the amount that you're paying for it does have an impact.
How essential is the ability to opt out or not pay?
That's definitely a factor. And if you can't opt out, it gets closer to being a tax. All of these things combined. And not every decision, every court opinion looks at them exactly. I mean, that's the nature. They may emphasize one over the other.
Yeah, it doesn't turn on just one. It's similar to tax and
criteria. Representative Helm?
Mr. Chair, I really think your question about how we move forward from here on this question is important. And I'd suggest that we're at a point in our work that we're looking for at a fatal flaw type of analysis, right? We're trying to kick a few things out that just won't work at all if we see them. And I think maybe that's the kind of document that would be most helpful. You know, is this an idea that will simply not fly constitutionally? I'm hearing that it could be constitutional today. As we move on, there might be concerns about how we avoid Commerce Clause or privileges and immunities problems. And we could seek some general guidance from LC about that, move forward without trying to get a fully formed idea of what the surcharge or tax would be at this point. That would let our work continue, and I think we could have some certainty that we're not wasting time on this concept.
Okay, so Kate, we've got four options. Three of them are a dollar amount. One of them is a percentage amount with some various exemptions. If we did that scenario, ask that question, given what information you have in front of you, are there any fatal flaws? Would your office be able to provide that information?
Something we could definitely explore.
Okay.
And I'm also, I will speak with Maureen McGee, who is, I'm the attorney in the office who handles most of the taxation matters, especially income tax. She deals with the portfolio, natural resources, and environment, and I'm sure we'll discuss this further as
okay.
We're preparing this.
Great. Thank you. Senator Whitsitt, then Kinsey, then... Well, we'll just go around the room here. Senator.
What was your question?
You're next.
I'm next?
We'll just go around the room with questions here. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Actually, I had already asked my question, but I forgot to put my card back.
Oh, okay.
But at
okay.
Advancing age.
Okay, Kenji?
That piece about the interstate commerce and wildlife crossing state lines is very interesting. But as a starting point, I just looked it up. I wasn't able to shepherdize it at all. But Hughes v. Oklahoma, 1979 Supreme Court case should give you guidance on that.
Not birds, perhaps.
That had to do with minnows and that states don't own wildlife, and therefore wildlife is not an article of commerce.
Right. That doesn't necessarily get to whether you can tax the out-of-state residents. I mean, I think there are a lot of different factors. It's interesting. I mean, definitely we'll explore it. But yes, that does ring a faint bell about them not being articles in interstate commerce. But yes, then the Dormant Commerce Clause and what it allows.
Okay, Jim, and then Mike, and then we'll close the conversation.
So, Kate, let me see if I'm listening right. Here's what I think I heard in that whole presentation is it's probably a tax. It's less likely to be a fee. But looking at your example of the Portland Arts Tax, it was upheld because there were some exemptions, because it wasn't a single tax that was given across the board to everybody. So in this case, where if we went ahead with the recommendations from our work group, which are that there be an exemption for low-income filers. Low-income filers would get off the hook. And the second thing was people who had a fish and wildlife license, hunting or fishing license, would get off the hook. The fact that that would be our recommendation would be similar to the arts tax, so therefore it wouldn't violate the head tax rule. That's what I thought I heard. Is that in a nutshell what it...
I think in a nutshell that's accurate, and certainly the Whitmire, which is the case dealing with the arts tax, talks about a per capita tax on everyone, an equal amount on all residents. That is what is impermissible. But the exemptions, that's what saves it. And that's because the voters at the time, that's what they were trying to prevent. The ill that they were trying to relieve was not having people who couldn't afford to pay the amount as people who clearly could.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Mike?
I'm not a lawyer and certainly not a tax expert, and I'm trying to understand. Is there a difference in the analysis or the approach to the analysis? One of the questions that we're sort of going round and round with here is how this all gets done, whether it gets done legislatively or whether it gets done through ultimately a ballot measure or what. And so does the analysis change if it's like a constitutional amendment as opposed to just some legislation that gets passed? You know, in other words, does that change the approach or how we intend to get this done? Does that change the analysis?
The only way it changes the analysis is if we were to amend the portions of the Oregon Constitution that make this an issue. That would not address the questions of the United States Constitution, because we can't by ourselves deal with that. But other than that, whether it's voted on, whether it's an initiative or a referral or just voted on in the legislature, the analysis won't change.
So the component that doesn't change is what, the commerce component?
So the United States Constitution, the Commerce Clause, that uh-huh. piece. And that's always going to be looked at under the federal constitution.
Okay, so here's what I would propose is that we've got, and thank you, Kate, for your presentation and your work, but we've got the verbal input from Kate, but in order to make sure that we don't have any, quote, fatal flaws, that we would ask staff, Jim, and maybe others to put together in writing a request to Kate's shop and say, here's the proposal as we see it. Do you see any fatal flaws? They would respond back to us, yes, no, maybe, those kind of things. And then we would have it in writing so we could know whether we want to move that forward or not. It just seems like we would want to get something in writing versus, well, we think it's going to work. Let's give it a shot. So is everybody okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Roger?
Good question. How long do you think an analysis like that would take?
Depends on what we find as we're researching, but probably not more than a few weeks at the outside.
2 weeks.
I think that's probably reasonable.
Okay, great. Well, Kate and Christine, thank you for your input. Even though Christine, yours was pretty short, but thank you for being there. Appreciate your time. So let's now move on to our second presentation, and we've got John Anderson. I'm sorry?
He's on the phone.
Oh, he is. Okay. So, John, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So you're going to talk to us about the Redemption Cooperative consideration. So welcome.
Thank you. And I apologize for not being present. I have an out-of-town guest from the East Coast that I planned to meet with before I knew I was had an opportunity to speak with you. So I apologize for that. But can you hear me okay?
We can hear you great.
Yep. Okay. Well, so my name is John Anderson, and I'm the president and CEO of Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op, also called OBRC. And I want to quickly go through a little bit of information on who OBRC is and then certainly open up for any questions that yourself or other members of the task force might have. So OBRC is a cooperative formed of beverage distributors or those that are in the business of distributing beverages. So we also would include many retailers, Safeway, Costco, Fred Meyer, retailers that would have a private label product and act as their own distributor. And then we may also have manufacturers, local craft brewers, and some of the new alternative beverages, teas, and things that might also be a manufacturer but act as a distributor. So all in all, we have 80-plus members, participants in the co-op. And in a nutshell, we administer, we manage on behalf of these distributors their responsibilities under Oregon's bottle bill. And that includes the administration of the deposit. So we collect all of the deposits once products are sold throughout the state. We provide pickup with physical tractors and trailers to about 2,600 locations around the state. We bring those back to 8 different processing facilities where we unload trailers with forklifts and move material into balers or silos or whatever it takes to get the product to the next stage of recycling. We also place and service a lot of the reverse vending equipment around the state that would be in grocery stores. The stores are responsible for the day-to-day maintenance, but they typically are leasing the equipment from the co-op. And then also we are opening bottle drop redemption centers around the state. And for those of you that aren't familiar with those, it's basically a standalone facility that takes back cans and bottles in an area that retailers were congregated in before, and replaces their responsibility for taking those containers back. And then we also are partners in a plastic wash and flake business that's in St. Helens, Oregon, and that is a facility that all of the plastic bottles that are returned throughout the state go to be ground into plastic flake, sorted out by color and other contaminants, and then washed in preparation to be sold for use in new plastic bottles or fruit, vegetable, agricultural type product trays. So that's really what OBRC does. We currently have a budget of about $27 million a year that we spend to fund these. We are in a rapid expansion mode with respect to the bottle drop redemption centers, as we're trying to get ahead of, which we won't be entirely ahead of, but as close as we can to the 10-cent deposit change that's coming in April of 2017, which we anticipate will increase the number of returns that consumers need to deal with, and distributors through us will need to manage in terms of extra trucks and processing capacity to manage those. So we're in a rapid expansion of that. Do you have an overhead, do you have any documentation up in front of you, or did you get any handouts?
We do. We've got a handout in front of us. It's pretty much going right down what you're talking about. So,
okay, well, perfect. Well, never mind. You don't need me. No. Let me just speak real quickly to the return distribution, which is on the first page of that in the upper right-hand corner, just so you get a sense of what the returns look like. There's about 2,400 convenience stores around the state. That's Plaid Pantry, just your mom-and-pop locations, 7-Elevens, and so forth. And they're currently getting back about 14% of the returns. There's 200 or so large grocers that are still taking containers back. That could be Safeway, Fred Meyer for rural areas. It could be a C&K market, a Roth's market, something like that. They're getting back about 43% of the returns. And then we have 16 bottle drop centers, as I mentioned earlier, that are open, and those are getting back 43% of the returns. So you can see just by those numbers that consumers have overwhelmingly shifted their return patterns from large grocery stores and C-stores to the bottle drop centers, which is a reflection of part of the convenience and features the bottle drop offers, but also I think it's a reflection of the challenges that they find at the retail grocery location. So with that amount of volume going through those centers, we're focused on trying to get more centers open and hopefully spread some of that volume and be prepared for additional capacities. So that's kind of OBRC in a nutshell in what we're doing. Would you like me to talk a little bit about our expectations for the 10 cents in terms of redemption rate and unredeemed deposits?
Sure, but just be aware we've got about 10 minutes more, and we'd like to leave time for questions in there too, please.
Okay, well let me speak quickly. If you on the back side of the page, I believe you have in front of you. Towards the bottom, there's two bullet points there. One says 2017 deposit increasing to 10 cents. We as a co-op, and we're probably the most knowledgeable in the state as we do this for a living. I've been with the company for going on 24 years now, so I've lived the bottle bill for a long time. Having said that, we don't have any particular insight into what will happen with the redemption rate. There is no magic formula that the industry would know that points to when you have a 5-cent deposit and you go to 10 cent, here's what you would expect. So we're estimating that it would go up to 85. That's somewhat of an educated guess. It's better than somebody that's never been around the business, but it is certainly not some industry technique that we use to estimate that. But I think maybe what most people might look at is the green box off to the right of the dime that says Michigan redemption rates at 10 cents. And you can see those are in the mid-90s. And that's the only other state in the U.S. that has a 10-cent deposit on all covered beverage containers. And they're in the mid-90s. So our mid-80s number is somewhat of an educated guess based on where we are today, perhaps based on the robust curbside program in Oregon. Not that Michigan and their towns don't necessarily have that, but maybe there's more of a focus on that in this state than there might be in Michigan. And we have more covered beverages than they do. They typically, or they generally are limited to carbonated soft drinks and malt-based beverages, so your beer class. So that's why we're estimating the 85 and not the 95. But it certainly, if we were to just look at it at the surface, that would be more of an example of a state with a 10-cent deposit and what the redemption rates are than anywhere else that you would find in the U.S. So let me leave it at that so that we have time to get to questions and maybe there's more to address.
Okay, so I have the first question, John. The 2018 bottle bill expansion that includes the teas, coffees, so that means we would go from 240 to 440 units. Do I read that correctly?
No, we would go from, in terms of the number of units being sold throughout the state, we would go from 1.6 billion units to an additional 240. I need to not the sales units, but the return units. We would go additional 240 million when the deposit goes from 5 cents to 10 cents,
uh-huh.
And then an additional 200 million in the expanded class. So those numbers are referring to what we believe will be going through the bottle bill.
So that'd be the increase in the bottle.
Yeah, those are the
440 increase. Yeah. Okay. Got it. Okay, and no doubt the reason that you're here is because one of our task forces is proposing for discussion using the bottle bill as a potential recommendation for a funding source. So, question, Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson, the data we have here said the returns are 14% small stores, 43% large stores, 43% to the bottle drops, which is 100%. So what about the curbside recycling? Which category does that fall into? How are they handled? And what becomes the deposits for the recycled at curbside?
Okay, well, good question. Well, they don't fall into any of those numbers. Those are just, when I say returns, that is return with a deposit refunded. So outside of that, that percentage is what ends up in landfill and what ends up in the curbside bin. So those deposits that aren't being returned, refunded to consumers, which includes landfill and curbside, are the deposits that are being used to fund the current bottle bill program. So when I talked about the administrative piece, obviously, but the tractors and the trailers and the forklifts and the plants and the reverse vending equipment and the bottle drop redemption centers, those are the things that the unredeemed deposits, those that are in the curbside bins and the landfills are being used to fund.
That answer your question, Senator?
Partially. I didn't hear you say what happened to the deposit on those that are recycled through the curbside.
Okay, well, the deposit is paid for all products that are sold to the co-op. So we are holding all of the deposits. Any deposit at the end of some period of time, if you will, that we determine is not going to be collected is what we would consider to be an unredeemed deposit. And so that deposit that we're holding is what the industry is using to fund the operations of administering and managing the bottle.
Oh.
That's the unredeemed deposit.
Quick question.
Any deposit that ends up not being paid back to a consumer, which would include a curbside container or a container that ends up in the landfill.
Okay. Tricia and then Merrill.
Yeah. Can you estimate what that dollar amount is currently and what the projections are for that dollar amount given the increase in redemptions alongside the increase in the deposit?
Sure. Yeah, that's good. That's a good question. So it's about $25 million currently. And if we go to 85%, which is our expectation, the amount stays at $25 million. Of course, you know, give or take a million, I know it's a big number, but still the number of containers are really big in the billions. So, but basically if the redemption rate or the amount of containers, number of containers that aren't returned is cut in half, even if the value of those doubles, the net available unredeemed deposit stays the same, right? If we cut the number of containers in half that are unredeemed, but each one of those unredeemed is worth twice as much, you still end up with the same amount of money as you had before. So that's our projection. It's about $25 million today. We're projecting that it will be about $25 million with the 10-cent change moving forward. What we haven't talked a lot about publicly, but is part of this discussion that those that are involved in more detail, is the cost of managing the overall bottle bill is going up dramatically with the changes related to the increased number of containers that are being processed and the rollout of the bottle drop, to the point where our budget this year is about $27 million. Our budget next year, we think, will be somewhere north of $30, $31 million. And then in each year after that, it's going up $3.5 million or so to accommodate the rollout of these bottle drop redemption centers, which are quite expensive to operate.
Thank you. Can I just ask one more question, please? Can you say again which states have a 10-cent deposit? Only Michigan.
The only state that has a 10-cent deposit on all beverages is Michigan. California has a bifurcated deposit with anything over 24 ounces being worth 10 cents.
And how many have a 5 cent?
A large number of containers, but not certainly not the bulk of the containers.
How many states have a 5 cent deposit?
There's 10 deposit states in the U.S., and so at this point, all but Michigan, 9 of them have a 5 cent. When Oregon goes to 10 cents, there will be 8.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Merrill, and then Scott?
Yeah, I have a few questions. Thank you. I was wondering, how do new participants become new co-op owners? So how do new people join those 80 co-op participants? How many people are employed through that venture? And if a portion of the additional nickel is diverted to another cause, i.e. funding the conservation strategy and our efforts, would how would that impact how many new people get brought on to work, or if there'd be any layoffs from your industry?
Okay, well, great questions. Let me start with how does a new participant join the co-op? Typically, they would be somebody that would be trying to sell their product into Oregon, and in the most in most instances, it's a small distributor, probably a local. In most instances, I would say it would be a craft brewer, but we also have some kombucha tea type distributors that would be trying to sell into Oregon, and they go to a store, and the store typically would refer them to OBRC or the OLCC for more information about how to manage the deposit. And so they would join our co-op through that process. But we also have different audit procedures where we're auditing what's being sold in the state. And if we find a product on a store shelf that we don't have a distributor manufacturer assigned to, then we'll pursue that and go after it. Hopefully that answers that question. With respect to number of employees, we have about 280 employees today. Each one of our bottle drop centers is an additional 8 employees. So we're still expecting to open another 30 bottle drop centers before we're done with our rollout. So we're adding another 240 employees to that, plus support staff, supervisors, that type of personnel. You asked what would happen if some or all of the unredeemed deposits were diverted out of the program. Well, I can't tell you all that might happen because it would be a broader question that the industry would face, probably united through OBRC, but could be individually. And certainly this is not a reflection on your efforts and the efforts of your committee. I happen to be an outdoorsman, and I appreciate the ODFW very much and have taken advantage of many of the resources. So this is not a reflection on that. But I think our as an industry, we've worked hard with a number of other constituencies over the last 9-10 years or so to put together a modernized bottle bill, a bottle bill that's reflecting the changes in the nature of Oregonians and how they respond to the bottle bill and opportunities around returning containers. But much of that is being funded by the unredeemed deposits. And my suspicion would be that the industry would find that to be in contrast to the things that have been worked out together, and would be concerned about continuing with some of the programs that we're doing that are very expensive. And one of them is a feature of our bottle drop where consumers can sign up for an account and fill a bag that we supply and drop that off, and we count that for them and credit their account that they can then use the money in that account. It participates in grocery stores, and in many of the grocery stores that are participating, they get a 20% premium if they use those funds in a grocery store. And that's something that we currently have, I think, 104,000 households around Oregon that are participating in, and that is substantially being supported by those unredeemed deposits. So it's that type of thing that potentially could go away, and I can see a lot of concern by those households that have signed up for that to see that feature disappear.
But from your perspective, this is just a follow-up, you wouldn't anticipate any layoffs of current employees, or maybe you'd have to lower the expectation of how many people you could bring on with those additional facilities if a portion of the 5 cents were diverted to some other program?
I don't know that I could answer if I would anticipate layoffs. I think, that's a big question that would have to be answered. I think it would be a resetting of services and features that the industry is providing through bottle drop in particular, but perhaps some other initiatives that are underway. We do quite a bit of community outreach and public education with respect to recycling the bottle bill and its anti-litter features. So I would just leave it at that. I don't know. I can't speak to layoffs.
Okay, thank you. We got to move on. So, Scott, we'll give you the last question.
Okay, two quick questions. First, you sort of answered. I was going to ask you how many bottle drops that you were going to build, and I think you said an additional 30. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so that would give you a total of 75. What are your plans after those capital costs are no longer part of your budget?
Well, the operating costs, I mean, the capital costs are one thing, but the operating costs per center are about $550,000 a year. So after the facilities are built and so forth, we still are recurring per center costs annually $550,000. And that budget number I gave you that showed that dramatic increase year over year, that's a result of adding those operating costs. Every center has these employees and has electricity and property taxes and all the things associated with operating a business that go on forever.
Okay, and then do your partners in the co-op, do they pay a fee to become a partner of the co-op, or do they provide any supporting resources for the operations of the co-op?
I didn't catch the last. What was the last part of your question?
Do the members of your co-op, do they have any responsibility to fund the co-op, or do they provide any resources to the co-op?
Yes, they do. It's a little bit complicated, but in short, everybody currently pays a fee, so the unredeemed deposits are not solely funding the co-op. The fee is dependent on, obviously, how many unredeemed deposits are available, but it's also dependent on the type of commodity that the distributor is selling and how much that commodity costs to handle. So I guess I could speak to this too. Any taking of a portion of the unredeemed deposits will hurt the rural members of the co-op, those outside, I would say, of the greater Portland metro area the most, because that's where our costs are the highest. And so we charge somewhat in proportion to what it costs to pick up that material. So take Tillamook, for instance. We have to run a truck from Portland out to Tillamook to pick up the product. And if you're a glass seller in Tillamook, say a craft seller in Tillamook, glass is expensive to haul and glass is expensive to process. So that type of area would be most hurt if we lose part of that funding.
But on the other hand, you could take Tillamook cheese with you on the way back home. So just
I like the sound of that immensely, as well as a quart of good ice cream.
Speaking as a guy from Tillamook. So we're not going to close it down. Senator, you're going to have the last word. So
thank you, Mark. Mr. Anderson, is the cooperative a private entity? And if so, does it have does the co-op have a contract with the state?
The co-op is a private entity. It doesn't have a contract with the state. It's a co-op, but formed under Oregon's C-Corp statute. So we're like an ag co-op. We're like, I don't know if the Tillamook Creamery Association is a co-op.
They are.
In that sense, but it might be.
They are.
Yeah, okay, at least the milk part.
Okay, does that answer your question, Senator? Okay, we'll close the discussion on that. And now, appreciate the two presentations that we've had. We're going to move into public comment right now. But before we do that, I want to acknowledge that we have an ODF&W commissioner here, Greg Woolley. Greg, are you? Glad to have you here, sir. Appreciate you making the time to come to our group. Thank you very much. Anything you'd like to say?
I just want to say that it's really important work that you're doing, and it's going to help shift the course of where our department goes. I know it's a lot of time and a lot of effort, and it means a lot to us, and it means a lot to me personally. So thank you very much.
Great. Well, and we'll be represented at your commission meeting on the 5th to give you just a brief overview of where we are with our task force. So. Okay, we've got public comment. I see one person signed up, but we're glad to if there's others. Nanette Jones? No, but that's the only one that signed up. But if there's others that would like to testify, we'll be sure and let them. So it's all yours, Nanette.
Well, thank you, everybody. I'm glad we were all able here to gather today to have these discussions. I appreciate all your work that you're doing. I would just like to, again, I'm going to make it real short, my emphasis on habitat. I think the more emphasis that we could place on funding habitat, whether through one of these options that you folks come up with, and then expanding the opportunities for non-hunting and fishers for the other 86% of the state, population of the overall state. To incorporate these folks in, since we want to get them to pay for it, that we expand some ideas about how to actually connect Oregonians with the outdoors. And I was in the task force today in the meeting, so I can comment a little bit about that, but I cannot comment on the conversation, the conservation part, because that was held in a different room. So being like the only member of the public participating in these talks, it would be, I'm limited on that ability to, because I was not able to participate in both. Although I did participate in both work groups last week, okay, but I could not participate today. So what I did experience up in the room about connecting Oregonians with the outdoors. I would like to see a more definitive goal breakdown of how this money is going to be allocated, a definitive concept around where we are going with communication to the public. Because I don't see, I mean, I don't, is my time up?
No, somebody just hung up. Go ahead.
I would just like to see a definitive breakdown about how the money is going to be allocated, the programs that will be funded, as well as, I mean, I've got the sheet, but like I said, I wasn't in the other meeting, so. The meeting about connecting Oregonians with the outdoors seemed to me to get a little stymied and around focusing on hunting and fishing issues, which is understandable, you know, and that's why I'm here to participate today, to throw my hat in the ring and be a representative for the 86 other percent of the population that can't participate today. Or our wildlife, who doesn't have a say on this, to say in this at all about how everybody's crafting money to go out and extract. So I would like to just allow, room, I hope, for us to come together where we can have an expansion of a more inclusive instead of inclusive our goals, right? And to bring together a more outlined definitive plan on how we are going to engage engage non-consumptive users, okay?
Okay.
Because it's important.
We're going to be talking about that in a little bit, so hopefully.
Yes. So I wish I could have participated in the other meeting this morning, but that wasn't possible. So thank you for your time, though. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Nanette. Anybody else like to provide comment to the group? Okay, seeing none, we'll move on. We're going to start now with the report from the work groups. We'll start with the conservation opportunities, and Rob has, I was going to say volunteered, has been volunteered to speak on behalf of work group one, and then Scott's going to speak on behalf of work group two.
I think everybody has a copy of the discussion summaries document that was circulated, certainly to our work group, and I think it was in the packet that you got before you came here. So if you put that in front of you, I'm going to walk through what we discussed in three meetings that we've had. I reported on the first meeting, which was our June 30th meeting, once before, but I'll just remind people of the essential elements of what we discussed at that point. Our basic program is to achieve conservation through the Oregon Conservation Strategy and the Nearshore Strategy, and to implement what's already in those documents as they're being updated. Both documents have been updated. The final approval of the documents is pending with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So the document, I don't think, is currently on the internet, but it will be shortly if it's not. So our funding objectives are all based on implementation of these documents. Those objectives are in the first column called Funding Objectives in the discussion summaries. And essentially, new money is needed for conservation, for species management, monitoring, data collection, species recovery, and data analysis. So it's all essentially science-based. There are huge gaps in the science capability of the agency, and we are trying to fill those gaps. The issues are somewhat different and characterized differently for the nearshore strategy, but they're also science-based. They need more research and monitoring because of overfishing. They need money for education and outreach, for management and policy development that arises from the data collection. And for them, fisheries and conservation are one and the same, but they don't have a good science underpinning for their work. So the shorthand thing we're trying to do is raise money for basic science and research and monitoring, and for both the nearshore strategy and the conservation strategy. But we also, the agency needs money to share the data that it gets from monitoring and its work throughout the agency with other agencies and with the public, and it doesn't have funds to do that currently either. There's a lot of science that's available in the scientific community and in science publications currently that the agency isn't simply able to access or integrate into its work, and they can't do that without more technical expertise and technical personnel. So their good decision-making is really dependent upon having good science, and they don't have good science today, and they're having to make decisions with inadequate information. In our next meeting on the 15th of July, we looked at three funding scenarios and tried to determine how much money the agency needs to address the issues I've identified. And the funding scenarios, I think you've also seen, if I'm not mistaken, and you may have those in front of you. But in there are various categories of funding. And what we asked the agency to do was to identify the full cost of funding its mission and to add to that some improvements we wanted to make in branding and marketing, and also funding for deferred maintenance, which has been discussed here over the course of several meetings. The total cost of those items was identified to us as about $86 million on a per biennium basis. And that assumes a continuation of general fund funding at the current level of $30 million. And obviously we don't have as a task force any control over that, but the $86 million requires a continuation of current funding levels. And our view is that we should be recommending the full package of funding and try to get an up or down vote from the legislature on a full funding without any fallback options and without tiered recommendations. However, in looking at the line items in the funding recommendations from the agency, we did adjust what is identified in their document as Scenario C by backing out two line items totaling about $8.5 million. The first of those is a fund shift for improving hunting and fishing of $5.6 million. And the second is a line item for $3 million for hatchery stabilization. And we did that because we think we're trying to fund the core functions of the agency, and these are not core functions and are included for, we think, questionable political reasons and could be deleted. The agency said in our July 15th meeting that it didn't have a problem with backing these line items out. So that would change the $86 million in round numbers by about $8.5 million, by reduce it by about $8.5 million to around $77.5 million per biennium. There is also a line item for conservation opportunities under Scenario C of $47 million, which has now been reduced by $8.5 million. And we didn't, we looked briefly at what the conservation programs are within that of $28 million and conservation grants of about $11 million and had discussions with the agency about those line items. But we didn't attempt to prioritize within the $28 million and leave that to the agency. We do think that the continuation of the conservation grants is a very important component of what they do, and we'll get into that a little bit later in talking about partnerships and leveraging and making the best use of ODF&W money. But there are some national models that the agency can use to set its priorities within the $28 million. And the staff, I think, is working on that, and we're not trying to recreate the wheel on that. So the new money that we're talking about would fund some existing programs and some new programs. There would be some relief or reduced pressure on fees for hunting and fishing. Hunters and fishers would still be funding more conservation than the general public would be funding on a per capita basis. So then we turn to look at funding sources, and we just had a conversation a few minutes ago with legislative counsel about our recommendation of a tax return surcharge. In our view, this has advantages that far outweigh any other of the funding sources that remain on our list. We have, I think, five on our list. We easily dismiss three of them. The bottle bill, in our view, is in general, too politically charged and entrenched, and there's too much already built into it. Operating funds are already unclaimed deposits are already being consumed by operating funds. There's well-funded opposition. We didn't see any reason to go down that path. However, we do recognize a distinction between the unclaimed deposits and the possibility, on the other hand, of looking at an excise tax on the sale of beverages generally. But in our view, the advantages of a tax return surcharge still far outweigh an excise tax alternative. We see that as being the most broad-based and fairest way to tax the general public in amounts that are, I think, achievable and fair and could be tolerated by the public. We think it's a scalable approach to raising money. It would raise an adequate amount, as we'll look at when we get to a discussion of the details here. It's much more politically realistic than some of the other alternatives, and it has the capacity to help solve other problems in its scalability, because it could, for example, help address issues such as Elliott State Forest or other conservation needs of state agencies. In looking at the tax return surcharge, we looked at two basic alternatives. One is looking at potential revenue per filing of each tax return, producing a flat rate surcharge, and potential revenue per individual, regardless of whether they are joint filers or individual filers. And clearly, the opportunity to raise significant funds and adequate funds is available only if we propose a surcharge per individual. And if you have the tax return surcharge materials in front of you that we were looking at a few minutes ago, our approach to this is to look at option number two, which exempts two classes of people, license holders of hunting and fishing licenses and low-income filers, with a $25 surcharge would produce $39.6 million per year, double that per biennium, and it is essentially at the amount that the agency needs on a per biennium basis. In our view, the surtax on income alternative, which would be a potential revenue source, is, although it introduces the possibility of progressivity in looking at this, it is a far more complicated proposal and doesn't raise significant funds, or by comparison, significant funds. We've had a lot of discussion in our group about vetting all of this, about having a clear written proposal and vetting it among people who have a lot of influence over whether it would gain political traction. Those groups include business groups, organized labor, sportsmen's groups, underserved groups. There are various organizations that could represent underserved groups and communities, and cities and counties. And we're going to have a conversation yet today about doing that, and perhaps the other task force looked at that as well. Today's meeting took us beyond this. I mean, we went back through the tax return surcharge issues and ratified our perspective of this, ratified our perspective that that's the appropriate direction we should be going. So that deals with the funding objectives and with the funding need issues. I want to go on here and talk for a moment about outcomes and measures in the third column. What we're looking for in terms of outcomes and hopefully metrics at some point is, first, as I mentioned earlier, the capacity to implement the conservation strategy. And in doing that, to provide resources so the agency can identify issues early, react to them before they come catastrophic and highly and much more costly than they need to be in terms of species protection in particular. Education outreach about conservation objectives. We want to have a shared responsibility for conservation in the community, and our funding mechanism does that. This would provide more predictable information on species through filling the science gaps. It would enable the agency to develop monitoring programs and action plans based on those programs to enable the agency to understand how to respond to challenges as they arrive. It would provide a transparent web-based account of what the agency does, and there would be contemporaneous accounting and evaluation of the agency's performance and how funds are spent specifically on conservation strategy and implementation of that strategy. It would also, one of our objectives is to have a communication strategy for sharing what the agency does with the public much more aggressively and openly than currently occurs. And we also have a suggestion for a conservation report card periodically so that the conservation work done by the agency is reviewed publicly and by the legislature on a periodic basis. In looking at program adjustment potential, we think most of this is a legislative function and a legislative budgetary function. But some of the things that would happen to the program based on what we're proposing is we would prioritize basic monitoring and prioritize science in a way that they can't achieve today in the agency with the funds they currently have. We would be allocating a lot more to conservation within the agency's budget than occurs today. And we, one program adjustment that I think the agency is receptive to and would make a lot of sense is to shift the administration of its grant-making programs to OWEB, which now has a fairly streamlined grant-making apparatus, and there isn't any reason for ODF&W to have to try to duplicate that. And they would want to retain the policy prerogatives with respect to their grant writing, but the administration shift could save money for the agency. We looked at leveraging opportunities and partnership possibilities with what we're proposing. They clearly would have a lot more ability to help other agencies, such as DEQ and others. There would be an opportunity for centralized data management, a database that is centralized and easily accessed. And there would be a possibility of collaboration with groups in the underserved community and the NGO community generally on a whole host of outreach and education programs. So that's essentially what we have done. I would comment, Scott, for your group, that we did this in a lot fewer words than you have produced. And, but,
you were on a good track until that.
Okay, let me. So, I would like to do this now. Is there any questions for clarification, or are there any other members of Group One that would like to add anything? We're not going to take positions yet. We're going to discuss both before we take positions. But any of the task force members want to add anything, clarify anything from Rob's report?
Is there a summary of the new budget proposal that your committee had, the breakdown of the revised funding?
There is, and I think it was distributed about 3-4 weeks ago. It's called Scenario 3 plus Deferred Maintenance.
Scenario 3 plus, okay, I'm looking through my materials and I was lost for finding it. So. We're all getting together with Beth later.
Yeah, we've got it. Jim's digging it out right now. So, any other questions? Yes, Meryl?
Yeah, I have a question related to the grant process and handing that over to OWEB. I was just wondering a couple questions. Did you talk about administrative fees to administer the grant that OWEB would need or would probably request for something like that? And then I'm just thinking about, once again, reconciling and messaging out. Here we're asking folks to, you know, pay in one way, shape, or form for ODF&W's work, and yet a component of that would be going into another agency, which people may or may not know about and care about.
Well, Roger, I might defer to you on this, but I think that the agency is in an early stage of thinking about how to handle this. And so there hasn't been any discussion with OWEB about it, to my knowledge,
right,
nor has there been any evaluation of what the cost might be to use OWEB for that purpose.
No, and just our initial discussions was basically, as you outlined, that rather than set up our own process, there's a process in place, and we would explore working with OWEB on that. There's obviously a lot of work to be done on that front.
Yeah, I'd like to be kept, and I'm sure others would like to be kept in the loop, because what I thought I heard was that, you know, they have everything in place, but I have reservations about that from folks that I know who work with OWEB and who have a different perspective on how they manage their grants.
Okay, Tricia, and then Brett.
Oh, I would just add that I'm one of the people who has no idea what OWEB is and what it stands for and what their history. So I think maybe therein lies some of the problem related to Meryl's statement.
Good point. Very good point. Yeah. Brett?
Just a question. Did work group one get into in the funding objectives? One of them is around habitat recovery, and we talked a little bit in our work group about how in the recreation context, ODF&W doesn't own and manage the habitat by and large. There are some areas, wildlife areas and whatnot, but given the amount of time wildlife spends on private lands or non-ODF&W lands in general, there's a need for, we're going to enhance habitat, or if the expectation that the public wants to achieve is around habitat gains, oftentimes it gets into the question with private landowners of, okay, well, we should pay for that then. So did you all get into kind of what the what money could be used for around habitat recovery, or is it more a general thing that's described in some degree in the conservation strategy already and have an area for discussion as to, you know, where that, what those habitat recovery programs could look like?
I think it's fair to say that we didn't make any modifications to the conservation strategy approach to that, and we didn't have a specific conversation about the distinction between public and private lands and how to manage habitats on private lands.
And I think you're alluding to we'd probably need to.
Well, I mean, it's not just in this work group, but I think statewide, and it comes up most legislative sessions, is this notion of what incentives exist for landowners to manage for habitat and for habitat gains. And who pays for that?
Mm-hmm.
Are the expectations on the landowners and the cost of other values? And if the public wants to see things recovered, that it's going to cost money to do, is it, you know,
mm-hmm.
can we have incentive based or volunteer programs that, and we do already, but do we build on those in some way with this kind of a funding source to enhance habitat recovery?
Okay. James, and then Jim.
Mark.
On my experience on the Sixth Ranch, we did major river restoration projects on the Wallowa River. It took 18 years to get the permits to do that. So it's not just that we're asking for support as landowners to do conservation work. More than anything else, we just need to be able to do it. So for the Department of Fish and Wildlife and other agencies to not be in the way. So there's not even a need for incentive or for funding. Landowners just need the permission. They want to do it.
Okay, Jim, and then Mike.
Well, in taking a crack at Brett's question, we did talk in our work group about what kind of the lowest hanging fruit was. Rather than propose a great big mega program here, which would create a whole new funding stream for on the ground work, the first order of business is for ODFW to have enough staff to have the good science information that actually directs available funds that are already available. Secondly, have enough staff to be able to even apply and have the match money to be able to apply for grant programs that currently exist that other states are taking advantage of and ODFW doesn't take advantage of because they don't even have enough budget to have the match. They don't even have enough budget to have the technical staff. And third, to have enough money to provide up-to-date science-based technical assistance to landowners that would otherwise invest their own money. There are, for example, counties in Oregon that allow people to have an ag deferment if they have a wildlife management plan. ODFW doesn't have enough staff to even help private landowners develop a wildlife management plan. They would get acreage for free for wildlife just by being able to provide that kind of assistance. So the first order of business before you go to a whole new big mega grant program is just beef ODFW up enough it can take advantage of landowners' own desire to manage their land better and provide the technical assistance and the match to take advantage of funding programs that currently exist. So in our group, we said, that's the first crack, and this proposal would at least beef up ODFW enough to be able to have the good science and the technical assistance horsepower.
So, Brett, did you have a follow-up to that?
Oh, no.
Okay. Thanks. So, Mike, was that you on the phone? Did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. Rob, I think that was a very nice overview and a good presentation. I thought I heard the word inventory once. I just wanted to underscore the natural resources management requires a good inventory. Unless you have a good inventory, you cannot monitor. And there are so many species, keystone species, that there is not a real good inventory. So I would just encourage the write-up to emphasize inventory and monitoring. In my mind, they go together like bread and butter or salt and pepper, only more importantly, because it's a scientific basis upon which you measure change, and you can also score your successes. So anyway, that's the only thing I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you. Scott.
I just wanted to add regarding the some payment and some guaranteed payment in lieu of that land being used. So I think there is potentially a model and probably something that we'd have to at least honor to get participation because most landowners are already aware of it.
Okay. Anybody else? Questions? Clarification? Okay. Yes, Senator?
Thank you. Mark, as you probably know, I'm the imposter on the Coastal Caucus. Even though I'm from Klamath Falls, I've sat on the Coastal Caucus for 10 years. And the nearshore strategy conservation is a little troubling from the standpoint of more money for monitoring and research. I think that's great. But to the extent that we might talk about enlarging marine reserves or marine protected areas, I think you would find those original asks were about a third of the Oregon coast, as you know. And they were negotiated down to a reasonable area for research and monitoring. And I think that anything that that would suggest that this group is asking for to expand those marine reserves or marine protected areas would have reaction from not only the Coastal Caucus, but the people they represent, and pretty negative. I just wanted to put that on the record.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Okay, let's move to work group number two, and since Rob provided a little shot there, you're welcome to provide a little shot if you'd like to.
Rob, just be glad you weren't in the meetings. There's many more words spoken than made it to the paper. I think that we started out with we're so broad in some ways because we didn't have like a conservation plan to kind of go off of. We were going off what the department was already doing in realization that what we really were pitching was a public information and outreach program to build participation within the citizens of the state. And so we were sort of starting in some ways with a somewhat blank paper, and I'll go through quickly some of the ideas that we had. I won't read this whole document, so if you want more detail, feel free to dig in and we can answer questions later. Our first objective was really to improve the engagement of the public in outdoor recreation opportunities related to and in support of healthy fish, wildlife, and habitat. And the outcome that we saw for that were several. And we realized that the first thing that we really needed to do, and I think Rob touched on it as well, as did some other members of the committee, is we also were in need of a baseline. And so we have somewhat of a baseline from the survey that the committee put out, but we really didn't have a broad baseline. And so some of what we wanted to pitch that the department do first is really start off with an analysis of the demographic trends and conduct a self-check, focus their potential realignment on these focus areas that had the most potential return. And so basically get a lay of the land and find out how best to spend resources to accomplish that mission. We needed to make sure that there were ODFW staff related to creation and delivery of recreational programming work beyond hunting and fishing, doing so using ODFW infrastructure facilities and beyond, and measure that diversity of and level of engagement in ODFW recreational programs. And at that point and the first point, we also realized that there are other state agencies that share this objective, Oregon State Parks potentially as one. So we thought that there was some opportunity to look amongst the state agencies for shared goals and objectives so that there could be some opportunities for partnership and cost sharing. So that we think that there is some opportunity there. We want to help Oregonians become more engaged in healthy outdoor places and experiences. And we talked about several ways to do that, and one way that percolated up to the top was really joining the digital age. And if you look at around the country, there are many states that have apps for ODF or for their similar departments as ODFW, New York, Wisconsin, New Hampshire. We looked at the New York app, for instance, and it provides some really cool opportunities, not just for hunting and fishing, but conservation, ways to share your experiences through social media. Try to create an app that not only eases the functionality of wading through ODFW regulations, rules, and licenses, but also something that can be used by participants as inspiration to their social circle and hopefully inspire other people to go outdoors and recreate. That one. Our next one was we want to improve educational outreach and engagement of the public related to and in support of healthy fish, wildlife, and habitats. We realized that this is a political campaign and we need the public to understand the importance of fish and wildlife in the state, and also by doing that understand the importance of ODFW and their mission. We believe that what they really need to work on to accomplish this objective is really largely around infrastructure and strategy. So building the staff capacity to work on the content development, potentially staff, potentially third party, depending on cost effectiveness and expertise level. Staff capacity to partner with others, agencies, tribes, NGOs, to do that educational outreach. In some cases, what we talked about, I think my computer just died. But anyway, what we talked about was, is the department going to be a producer of content or a deliverer of content or both? And in what cases should they be what? Should they create content, and are there NGOs and other agencies that are better as the vehicles, and are there others that aren't? Thank you, sir. That's what happens when you don't bring your charger. God, we do have quite a lot of stuff on here, don't we? Okay,
hold on. And I edited it down.
You edited it down? Wow. Okay, we can blame Brett for most of this. So I got most of that. We do feel that there could be a change because we could bring in other entities as far as cost for the department. Entities as diverse as tribes, outdoor school, NGOs, really whoever has the reach and the capacity. As we went further, one of our other key points was engagement of diverse and underserved communities. And that was also really a question about infrastructure and strategy and making sure that the department had the correct infrastructure and cultural competence to adequately address different groups about the state. We talked about that also could include language translation, potentially an app in multiple languages, website in multiple languages, things that are going to help ease that area of access. If you look at the demographics of today, people look for ease of access, and if there's not ease of access, they find something else that's ease. So we want to help build that into the system. When we talked about funding sources, we didn't narrow it down quite as much as the initial group. We really had based most of our conversation on trying to determine how we could create some outcomes and some potential measurements, and we did throw in some measurements in there. You can see those in the document. We did decide that we thought there were three funding sources that we were still open to consideration. One being the funding source that the first group identified, the second being some form of the bottle fee or taxation, and then third, we had some interest still in some tie to the marijuana tax. And that's the short version of the long notes.
So you didn't actually zero in on a funding proposal. You just had three options because coming out of that.
Yeah, part of it was we were still sort of trying to figure out, okay, if we're doing this communication program, you know, do we have a set cost for each year? Is it going to be a phased-in approach? How do we adequately secure the money to do something that could take multiple years? And we didn't really dig down that far into how that could be secured.
Okay. So other questions for clarification or comments from the
group
two?
Anyone else in the committee?
The only thing I'd add, I mean, given that Meg is in the room, I think we talked a little bit about opportunities in a lot of these recreational opportunities and educational or partnership opportunities with either other agencies in the state, federal agencies who have a lot of public land to manage, and then NGO and other private sector opportunities too. And we had, I think, two other things, I guess. On diverse and underserved communities, that part of HB 2402, the work group wanted to speak to that as this is not just, the focus is on low-income communities, yes, communities of color, people who are or communities and people who are not traditionally kind of networked into what ODFMW does, but also with some discussion in today's meeting around people with disabilities, and that community is also being part of the notion of who we're trying to reach. And there's a lot of overlap, I think, in as we try to look at spreadsheets that distinguish between the conservation objectives work group work and this work group number two work group's work. It's not easy to totally segregate them and separate them because a lot of what's needed around ODFMW capacity on science relates to conservation, but we talked, you know, today a bit around trail planning. You know, if there's going to be an enhanced effort to engage public and outdoor recreation related to trails, whether it be for mountain biking or other uses, there's a need for staff capacity that can inform this planning decisions around where do you put those, how does that relate to habitat, how does that relate to wildlife. In the fishing context, if we're looking at building on what Oregon already does really well with kind of certified and sustainable fisheries, you need the science underpinning to get those sustainability certifications and to promote that kind of a fishery, which is, you know, if you just look at the fishery, it's a recreational or a commercial opportunity, but the science not just on that end, but also on the kind of sustainability conservation end.
Yeah,
a lot of focus on partnerships and the grant. I think what's common is one thing that's common between the two subgroups is the idea of using a portion of the new funding source for grants and contracts related to partnering with private NGO sector entities, some of which may have more expertise in doing things like outreach and marketing, and also focusing on where, you know, ODFMW doesn't have strength in connections or a long history of relationships within certain communities, the need to, or the trust relationships in those communities, the need to work with others to build the relationship, which is starting in a different place from, say, hunter education, where there's a deep history of building that program and trust and volunteers associated with it. That may be a model, though, that could inform how that could be done around the non-hunting, non-fishing type outreach.
Yeah, I think we noticed that there was a lot of collaboration potentially in that messaging, where we wouldn't want to just have one of those single messages when we have an audience. They're really tied together, and so there could be some efficiencies there. We also thought if there was a way to go with an app for the conservation group, that could be a way to really acquire real-time scientific data as far as catches and takes, if that was used to report in hunting and fishing arena, where you had GPS and you had photographs and other availability to bring in data real-time.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, yes, Senator.
I just wanted to address briefly the state agencies often work at cross purposes, and specifically the Health Authority, the Department of Environmental Quality, the Department of Land Conservation and Development, Department of State Lands, often take actions that make it more difficult for the public to use the great outdoors. I'll just give you one brief example. About 3 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, the Oregon Health Authority came out with a set of administrative rules regarding organizational camps, you know, day camps, week-long camps, and so forth. And those rules would have functionally put them all out of business. I mean, one of the more egregious rules was that even wilderness camps would have to have temperature-controlled hot water. Senator Johnson and I addressed those administrative rules and forced them to draw them back. They went back to the industry, and I think they got it worked out pretty well. I say Senator Johnson and I. Senator Johnson can be quite forceful, as you may know. And in any case, we
really
got that done. But my point being that no matter what ODFNW does, if they're hamstrung by the other agencies, we're not going to have more access to the public, to public lands for the people. So, I mean, it's something that, Brett, I think you need to take into consideration and look. Too often, state agencies, you know, one hand is supposed to be washing the other, and they have no idea what the other is doing.
Yep. Yeah, Senator, point well taken. And we talked about that, how what is ODFMW's role in this space versus the role of other agencies, and where we're talking about outdoor recreation, that ODFMW has a role in promoting, whether it's hunting, fishing, or wildlife watching, or other forms of recreation. It's often on somebody else's land, and there may be other state agency programs that have existing programs that relate to that land. So I think that's one high-level thing that we flagged is it's not just a need to put money into ODFMW, although there is the base capacity and the need to enhance the capacity of the agency. It's also a need to address the coordination across state to state, but also state to federal.
You know, Brett, another example, a couple of years ago during the drought situation, Department of State Lands closed several lake beds in Lake County to public access. And that was negotiated, and as soon as it rained, they withdrew it. But the department was actually considering the pros and cons of simply eliminating all access to state-owned lands, you know, anything within a meandered lake area, just as a preemptive strike. And to people in Lake County or Harney County or whatever, it was would have been ridiculous. And not only from the standpoint of those people, but for the all the people who bring their snowmobiles and ATVs and so forth to go out in those areas. So I think that, again, I don't want to beat it to death, but I mean, it's something that really needs to be addressed.
Yeah, and that raises, I don't want to belabor this, Chair, but we could get into, this hasn't been mentioned yet, I think in either work group, but I imagine both work groups have discussed it, is the issue of enforcement and the role of the capacity around enforcement, where, like, a lot of times these conflicts will come out of issues where use in one form or another and use by someone who may not represent the broader user group, but who may have done something that gives everybody else a black eye, they have, that triggers a conversation that I think what you're talking about can get into others saying agencies shouldn't be overreacting to isolated incidents and doing things with a broad brush. But on the other hand, with increasing recreation pressures, I'm not just talking about hunting and fishing or poaching, but other impacts from outdoor, different types of outdoor recreation, there's a growing segment of the public who are engaging in the outdoors, but not necessarily a growing ability to manage the impacts. And so, at least in the, we didn't know in our work group whether the enforcement conversation was kind of spanned both work groups, and we didn't have it necessarily tagged as this fits in the spreadsheet tied to work group number two, or it fits better in spreadsheet number one tied to that work group, the spreadsheet tied to work group number one. But at some level, there's conversation needed around how do we have the enforcement capacity to address issues so that they don't bubble up into some larger controversy, and that the recreational use is commensurate with the notions around how we make sure it's sustainable and achieving conservation objectives.
Okay, so we're going to take about a 10-minute break, come back at quarter till, but why we're, oops, I'm sorry, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With your indulgence, I have to leave for work here in about 15 minutes, so I won't be here for the afternoon session. And I wanted to address the bottle deposit idea as a revenue stream today in some way. I know that you indulged me before and the rest of the electeds in asking our opinion. Earlier we're talking about fatal flaws analysis and in which type of revenue strategy we move forward. In that category, it's my personal belief that trying to get at the bottle bill unredeemed containers as a source of revenue is a fatal flaw. We're going after another group's money under a system that is now, after decades of dysfunction, finally working with the bottle drops. Finally, we have the grocers and distributors and this entity doing the work that Oregonians want to have done, which is to get the litter off the streets and off our roads, off our beaches. I think we're going down a very unproductive path if we continue to pursue that as an option.
Do you have an opinion on the income tax surcharge?
I very much like that idea.
Okay.
And that's fundamentally because we're not taking another group's money. However, if the group wants to consider the 1 cent per container additional tax, I don't think that we'll be interfering that much with any other entity's objectives vis-a-vis the bottle bill. So that one I think we could leave, but let's leave the unredeemed deposits behind.
Okay, Kenji, quick question.
Representative, quick question. Would the 1 cent be sort of, would your attitude toward the excise tax be the same thing as the 1 cent on the bottle?
No, and I don't think you'd find the industry's reaction to that would be necessarily negative either.
Okay.
Because what you're talking about is a different administration of who collects the 1 cent and how it gets to the state, and it doesn't
essentially detract from John's budget, as he was describing to you earlier.
Okay. I want to, on behalf of the task force, thank you for making the time to be here today. We appreciate it. So we're going to take a 10-minute break. So about 10 minutes till, but while we're on the break, I want you to be.
I was talking to James and not Brendan Hillsky.
Oh, I got a mess here.
This is good camming. I got to worry about all these crazy nurses. I met him a few years ago when they had something on the road.
Okay, if we could get everybody back in their seats. Okay, let's go. We had a little bit of a discussion. Hopefully, you've had discussions too in the interim here during the break. So, I thought I'd try to bite off the first one and the easy one. We'll see if this is easy. Is there any additional information that any of the task force members want to add or clarify from the two task force report? Otherwise, what Jim and staff have heard, they'll just combine that into our report, which will be the two task force reports. So is there any additional information? So.
Do we have the opportunity to meet again?
I'm sorry?
We have the opportunity to meet as a group again. I think for our group, it might be wise if we were to maybe center down more on some of our funding options, at least maybe one of the bottle options versus having it be so.
Well, we're going to discuss that, which options. But, I mean, in terms of the meat, not the funding portion of it, but in terms of the meat of what you presented, is there any additional information that you'd want to add? Yes, Claire.
I don't know if this is additional information or if I'm still suffering from jet lag, and I apologize if you already said this, Rob, but our group also touched very briefly upon the fact that it's from a scientific standpoint, and I think Mike Finley addresses too, it's not just about monitoring, but using the information to inform decisions about keeping common species common and improving the status of those that are suffering, and,
yep,
and not,
we did
not
talk
just
that.
Focusing on endangered species.
You didn't,
so.
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
It was said. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm, yes, Rob.
Our task force had a variety of ideas about leveraging and partnerships, and I didn't go through all those ideas. Jim heard them all. So I'm happy to send you an email to augment what you have in your notes. And we had a few other conversations that I didn't relate because of time constraints, some of which were some of Jim Martin's comments, et cetera. And I'll give you that information as well in case your notes don't have it.
And luckily we had some good note takers at both meetings. So our intent would be to respond to the six questions we presented to both groups and to meld what's come out of the two work groups thus far, as well as incorporate unique ideas that were captured by the other group.
Okay, so I'm hearing that we're pretty much, oh, I'm sorry, James.
We did spend quite a bit of time today talking about the value and benefits of a mobile phone app. I just wanted to make sure that that was highlighted in what we're going to be looking at.
Okay. So noted. Okay, so now what I'd like to do, if everybody's okay with this, we need to narrow down our options. And there are this document here has five options. So it's my belief that, well, in talking with Jim, we can move forward with a suite of options. We can narrow it down to the vital few or the vital one, however this task force wishes to do that. But I want to see with your cards, one of the options was lodging tax. I personally haven't heard too much about that. So do we keep that on the discussion of the lodging tax, or do we take it off? Jim, do you have a comment on that before we?
Yeah, so thinking about context of our report to the legislature would be, we started with 40 plus scenarios, and we, through a process of evaluation criteria, ended up with five that we thought had some serious merit. Upon further reflection, we really ended up looking at only two. You really only looked at two of these five. There's been no conversation about the other three. We're not telling the legislature that those ideas have no merit. What we're saying is that we focused on one or two concepts as best achieving our evaluation criteria.
Yeah, so
I want to make a distinction that, for example, more general fund money still moves forward in our report to the legislature. They're just saying that we didn't find it to be the most viable vehicle to accomplish our objectives.
Well, and it's my belief, we actually looked at, our report's going to show whatever that was, 40 options, and then we took that 40 and we narrowed it down to, I think, like eight, and then we further refined that down to the five, and we further refined it, but they'll all be in there, but we've got to zero in on what we're going to make for a recommendation. So maybe that's just another way of saying what you just said. Kenji?
So some of these options have actual sub-options. Do we want to kick off some of those sub-options? Because as Representative Helm indicated, for example, the unredeemed deposits probably would not work, but the option two under that could.
So, yeah, I was thinking of trying to see if we could, I think there's some that are not going to stick on the wall. I mean, the bottle stuff and the surcharge, I think we're going to have a significant discussion on that. But
but the other ones, okay.
Yeah, so we got the five, we know that. So is the general fund, lottery fund concept, do we want to carry that forward as a task force? Red, green, yellow. So
which one?
Red, green, the general fund one.
And Mark, when you say carry it forward, meaning stays in the report, but carry it forward, meaning we do more work on it, we put more effort into it,
we need to really seriously consider this as part of our funding scenario. So, okay, I'm seeing green, one yellow, and the rest are red. So if everybody's okay with that, we're not going to move that forward in terms of a recommendation. It'll still be on the list that we looked at it. That's going to be the legislature that's going to decide that, not us, on how the general fund. Okay, so the lodging tax was another one that the group had on the list, but it's not part of the, at least the proposals that we've heard from the two task forces. So we got green, one
Mark,
more.
Can,
yes, Mike.
Mark, can I comment on that?
Oh, sure. I'm sorry. I didn't even. What were you on the general fund lottery?
Oh, I support that.
You support moving that forward then?
Yeah.
Okay. So we got.
I wanted to comment on the, unless I missed something, I've never seen a full-blown analysis of the lodging tax. In other words, how many room nights are there in the state of Oregon? And, you know, what an analysis would show whether you get, I use the example of Seattle, $2 a night per room, what that revenue would be. Did I miss that somewhere?
If you increase the lodging tax by 1%, it would bring in $16 million per year. If you increase the lodging tax by 0.1%, it would be $1.6 million a year.
Well, see, but there's not the $2 per night per se done. I mean, I feel it's incomplete analysis.
Okay. What's the group think about that? Jim?
Well, I just disagree. I think that the fundamental reason we turned it down the first time was listening to Kerry about the kind of conflict it's going to create and the kind of opposition it's going to create from all the people who've worked to manage that lodging tax as it currently is. So to me, you could raise it enough that you could meet the money, but it would be violate our criteria about the narrowing bays versus the widening bays and trying to avoid the political conflict. It just seems to me we can cut to the chase and say the fundamental choice before us is do we forward one proposal or two? We ought to focus what time we have left for a conversation about those choices rather than going back to the drawing board and showing cards on everything else.
Okay.
Well, I disagree. The thoughts there were protecting the lodging industry, which is the wrong approach to this. The approach is to evaluate those people who come and stay in Oregon and how they could support the natural resources they come to see, sense, and enjoy. We never got into any of that. We just had defense of the lodging industry. We never heard from the lodging industry. But I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, so now we've heard 2 points of view on it. So let's go ahead and take a polling one more time. Mike, I'll consider you're a green on that. So I see I see one other green, and I see the rest are red. So the majority is that we would take it off of the list. It's still on the list. I don't want to. It's still there, but it would not be a priority for us moving it forward.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I probably should have said this earlier. As we'll discuss in a minute, over the next 6 weeks, we're proposing a soft touch program with key constituencies.
Yep.
And going into mid-September, what I would call preliminary recommendations, and seeing how the legislature reacts, to make the best use of our efforts over this remaining time from the staff's perspective. Limiting the number of things we're talking to constituencies about is advantageous. If I'm out having to talk about 5 funding scenarios, that's 5 times as many groups as I'm going to have to talk to. So it's what we're really concerned about is what we can accomplish over the next 6 weeks before we show up in front of the legislature to say this is our best thinking to date.
Tricia.
So I'm not challenging the vote because it was pretty clear where people are, but I do feel like one of the comments that was made was around the lodging industry and the impact that would have there. And I guess I would raise the question around Airbnb and vacation rental by owner and other elements of an emerging industry in Oregon that might not be impacted in the same way. I don't know. But I just want to raise it as a question in case at some point there's opportunity to revisit this, because I think that might not be an area where there is the same kind of organized resistance, because I do feel like it's a heavily unregulated emerging industry.
Okay. So the last one is marijuana. Cards on that? Marijuana tax? There's... Okay, Mike, it's all red. What's your opinion on that?
I still like Ken's proposal to at least, unless you discuss something that I missed about increasing the rate, the percentage point rate, rather than trying to divvy up the existing money. I don't think you're going to get anywhere trying to divvy up the existing pot, but the concept of increasing the tax rate by a percentage point or two is different. So, you know, I'll go with the group, but I'm not sure I remember the evaluation or the discussion on the difference between staying away from the existing division and increasing the tax rate as a potential.
Well, we did have option one of increasing it by 1%, which would bring in $600,000 a biennium. So it wasn't a big amount. It was a fairly small amount. And then one was reallocating the revenue. So, okay, so.
Counting is red then.
Okay.
Let's make a comment on that. Sure. I would say that if, as is anticipated, there is a relook at how the tax is going to be dispersed across agencies, that ODF&W be ready to jump in on that conversation as well.
Okay. Okay, now let's have what I think is going to be the spirited discussion, maybe not. But so we have the tax return surcharge, which group Task Force 1 is proposing, and then we have the bottle bill, beverage container deposits, options 1 and 2 there. So I think we're all aware, hopefully you've all had a chance to, is there any questions for clarification on those? Okay, seeing none, so it's now let's decide, do we want to move them both through as a, this is what our thinking is, it's not a complete recommendation, but we'd like to vet this with our interest groups and see what their thoughts are regarding that, and then see what their input is back to us, and then we would come back in August and have a conversation about here's what the interest groups are saying, here's what Association of Oregon Industry is saying, here's what the counties are saying, here's what the conservation community is saying, back and forth. And so then we would have a perspective that we could decide whether we want to go with one or two or one or both of those. The other option is we can decide right now whether we want to go with the tax return surcharge. There's four options there that we could discuss. Or do we want to or drop all of those or just go with the bottle concepts? So what's everybody's thinking? So you kind of see it's wide open now. Yes, Jim.
My thinking, and you heard Rob talk about all the criteria that our work group recommended in going with the one with the individual tax filer being the best strategy. I prefer one with all of these as our kind of backup plan based on what we hear. But I can live at this stage with two if the other group feels so strongly about it, and we can vet it, and we can discuss it, and we can try to finalize our best proposal at the legislature. But I would prefer that we have a conversation about the upsides and downsides and try to see if we can't come together as a group and settle on one preferred option. As Jim mentioned, we're going to talk about the other things that we considered, and we're going to have ideas about what we thought the advantages and disadvantages of those were, and people are going to have a chance to share their thoughts with us. But if we get all the way to the legislature and we bring two ideas forward, what I'm afraid is they're going to slice and dice it all up. We're going to end up with some kind of a hybrid, and in the process, we're not going to get enough money out of the deal, and we're going to have double the administrative costs, and we're going to have double the sense of opponents. And just from a practical politics point of view, I think it's much smarter for us, at least after the vetting, but I would hope right now, to say this is our lead idea, and it's based on our criteria.
So let me see if I understand. So you're saying that you would be okay with moving the two forward to the constituency groups, but if you were personally doing it, you would narrow that down to one?
Yes.
Okay. Got it. Rob?
I agree with Jim, and I'd say that our work group has the same view. There was clear consensus in the work group. But I would say, at a minimum, we have three on the table now, not two. We have the surcharge, we have unredeemed deposits, and we have a beverage container tax. I'd say, at a minimum, we should get the unredeemed deposits off the table so that we have two and we can talk about two alternatives.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
Is there cards on that?
You want green or red?
Green. That would be green to get that one off the table. The unredeemed off the table would be a green. So, okay, that's Mike, that's all green. Are you okay with that?
Absolutely.
Okay, got it. Okay, so we're down to two. Any other thoughts with Jim's proposal? Yes, Mike.
Well, I was about to take my card down. I agree with Jim. I agree with Rob. It just occurs to me that on the beverage tax, it certainly raises money, but it doesn't fully fund the conservation plan, whereas the other plan does. So, I mean, there's no question I lean heavily on the surcharge, the tax surcharge concept, because we can fully fund the Oregon Conservation Plan. And we can do it in a manner that meets virtually all of our established criteria. It's not clear to me that we can do it with a 1% beverage tax. No, you know, if we're So I think we've got to determine, are we going to fully fund the conservation plan, or are we going to partially fund it? So I think that, you know, if we're going to leave that on the table, we've got to have that conversation.
Okay. So I may be going out of order here, but Representative Helm did weigh in, and he's not a voting member, but I would like to, if Senator Whitsitt or Senator Edwards wishes to give an opinion on this. I know you're not voting members, but, and you, of course, don't have to give an opinion, but the opinion would be on the beverage container tax. Do you have a, do you have any thoughts for us? No.
I will repeat what I've said before. I don't want to be a damper on this process, so I see great, enormous political obstacles in the Capitol to all of the things that have been brought forward. I'll just leave it at that. I mean, it's
thanks. Well,
if it were easy, we wouldn't have a task force, correct, and we wouldn't be meeting. I mean,
we're doing your bidding, though.
So you've asked us. You know, you were wise to get the unredeemed deposits off the table, because that definitely wouldn't fly. You're going to have different constituencies that are opposed to increasing the deposit or doing a tax, a beverage container tax. You're going to have the 3/5 requirement, so you're going to have to come up with both, votes from both parties. And then, there are a lot of groups that would like to have, I'm sure, a dedicated amount, and a lot of departments and agencies across state government that would like to have a dedicated amount on, however much on their tax return to fund what they think is the most important aspect of state government. And most of them are a lot bigger and more powerful than the interest here in this room. So, and it hasn't happened. So this is tough. This is tough work, and I don't know what the outcome of this task force is going to be. I've kept my comments to myself as much as I could, because early in this whole process, it was apparent that was it brought nothing but negative energy to the group. So, and wasn't going to help you get your work done. So that's what I have. Okay. That's what I have to say.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the candor, Senator Whitsitt.
Well, not to pile on the negative energy, but there's a budgeting process, and it's a competitive process, and everyone has a wish list, and it's a balancing act of, what is needed the most, what are the best benefits, and frankly, who has the most lobbying power. And so I think at this point our work process leads, we don't really have an indicator what we need specifically or how that need will be addressed by spending more money, how it will be funded. We're talking about, we haven't really addressed what the roll-up cost will be, and in any budgeting process, you have to know not only what it's going to cost this biennium, but the next biennium, the next biennium. And we really haven't addressed performance measures as to how will we measure, if we have this need and we're going to address this need, how will we measure if that addresses that need has been addressed? I mean, those are the things that the budget process works at. Often not too well, because it gets sidelined by, frankly, by powerful lobbying interests and so forth. But I mean, that is the methodology, and I don't think that we have made a case that will stand up to the competition without being more specific.
Thank you for your candor, Paul, and then Scott.
Well, to the income tax surcharge and the idea that covers everything, I guess it does, depending on how high you make that surcharge. But the figures that we had And one of the earlier assessments here was, you know, for every $10, if you exempt license holders and low income, you're only $10 surcharge, you're pulling $9 million a year. So to me, that still falls well short of the total needed to fund this strategy, unless you want to jack it up to, what, about $100 a year, something like that, which is a whole different story. So I think we need to keep the beverage container discussion alive as part of this.
Well, it'll still be on the table. Yeah. It'll still be.
But I don't know that we can put all of it in one basket.
Okay. Scott, you're up.
Just getting back to the idea of having one or two ideas as we talk to stakeholders. My experience when I'm talking to our stakeholders and our business is if I go to them with one idea, then it's a yes or no conversation. And if I go to them with multiple, then it's a true conversation. And I would say even if we didn't feel super strongly about two, I think it would be a mistake to go with just one.
No, I didn't get the last part.
I think it would be a mistake to go with just one idea because I think we want to have a conversation. We want to give them an opportunity to have some investment in the process. And if we go there too big, then it's too one side of a conversation.
Okay, Jim and then Brett.
So a proposed approach. So we have a target out there of about $80 million we want to achieve. And I think whatever goes forward should be able to meet that target.
Right? But you're saying it's 80 minus 30, right? Because 30 is part of the Fed money that's already included in the 80.
I think one of the assumptions is we should not assume that federal money.
Yeah.
I thought that was just the federal money that already came to the department.
No, there's 30 in general fund.
So oh, okay.
The assumption was it's 80 in addition to the 30.
Oh, in addition?
The assumption was the 30 in general fund would remain, which is not something that maybe we should assume, but that is the assumption that's going into the 80.
So if you operated, if you were using that as an operating principle that we need to generate approximately 80, what if we move forward the beverage container tax at a level that achieves that, which means we're going to have to do some more research to see whether that's 3 cents or 5 cents. The other is that on the tax returns surcharge, we would look at option two. It's going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 or $25 per individual return. That's what you have to do to get there. Now, the exercise we're going to be engaged in is going out and saying, hey, folks, this is our thinking. What's your reaction? I think it'd be better to shoot at a higher thing and to say, we'll never support a $25 surcharge, but we'd support a $10. That'd be good information for us. But if we start at 10 and have to bump it up later in order to meet the goals, I think that we're pushing the rock uphill. So I would just recommend, let us play with these. We're going to get information from Legislative Council. Whatever options you move forward, let us structure them to meet an $80 million goal. And then funnel two of them out there at the same time.
So, Jim, that flies in the face of what you proposed.
I think that's a good suggestion.
Oh, you do? Okay. Okay.
Okay.
How about everybody else with that? Kenji?
Just a quick note. Instead of a cent, I'd actually recommend going to a percent just because that will keep up with inflation and you don't have to go back.
And I think what we'll do is we'll ask Legislative Fiscal to kind of calculate those type of options. Is it cents or percent?
Okay, so
at this point in the process, we keep getting information that shows how much additional revenue. It'd be really great if you could just compile it in a fashion that shows, okay,
here's our
existing
target
revenue streams. This is what we got now through license revenue, federal contribution dollars, so on and so forth. And, and start with the number where we're trying to get to, show what we've got, and then plug in these two different scenarios. You know, just so we can see it all on one sheet of paper now. Okay,
gotcha. But understand, Mike, the $80 million is new money.
Yeah, it's all new money.
I get
all
that.
New money.
I'm just saying if you could provide it in a summarized fashion, it'd be handy to look at.
So you want to show it as about a 25% increase in the agency so you can put it into context?
I just want to see it in the context of the Oregon implementation of the Oregon Conservation Plan. What do we got today? What do we need to get there? And just show it all in one picture.
So let's see cards on Jim's proposal of a package that gets us to $80 million, and it would include a combination of both of those. Not saying you would support that or not, but just the combination versus going one only. Okay, it's all green, Mike. Are you green on that or not?
No, I think it's smart to have more than one egg in the basket.
Okay. Brett?
This is Nancy Bales on the phone.
Oh, hi, Nancy.
Yeah. Hey, hi. So, and I want to just pop in and say I support that as well.
Yeah, I didn't realize you were on. I'm sorry.
No. That's all right. I just got on a little bit ago.
Okay. Brett.
Thanks, Mark.
So, unrelated to this, I mean, it's more on the income tax surcharge question, so I don't know if you wanted to do a show of cards first, but it's a...
Oh, we did. And we got green all the way around at...
Mark, I was a little bit confused about that last because it kind of got muddled in terms of the vote. Mm-hmm. What exactly were we voting on again?
What did we just do?
Go ahead.
On the income, on the tax return surcharge, we heard from legislative council that we better have an exemption. I think it would be smart to proceed with the dual exemption,
which is option two.
Option two.
Which produces at $25 for individual filings, $39.6 million.
At the same time,
individual.
We'd like
here.
To proceed with option four, right? Because we want to keep that on the table in case that is more constitutionally palatable to have a percentage versus a flat. So keep a flat with two exemptions and a percentage on the table while we get some more legislative council research.
Then the second one would be the
bottle
tax.
And then the bottle.
The second one is the
enough of a bottle
beverage
tax
container tax.
To make the $80 million.
Adequate to fund my continuing consulting fees, yes.
For a year.
Okay. That's clear. Thank you.
Yeah, you got it.
Can somebody, I missed, was there a conversation about how if there was, let's say there was a 1% tax on beverage containers, as it shows here, how that would get implemented? Was there a discussion about that? Would that be done at the wholesale level?
Yeah, we talked about that.
We did, okay.
The wholesale level.
Right, okay.
Okay, and remember, this is what we would take out to, this isn't our final, this is what we would take out to the interest groups that we represent and see if there's, what do you think of that idea? So this is not in stone, this is the way we're going, this is still to be discussed.
Yeah. On that, I mean, one thing to consider is, I think the number that you all as a task force are looking at is, it's like you want to and have to come up with, all right, this is what it would cost, we feel, to fully fund the objectives that we're setting out. In vetting with different communities that have been outlined in the document that you provided, there's not, I don't know that it's as essential to be talking to that set of stakeholders about $25, $35, or even, you know, we need $80 million. It's more, I think the vetting is around the concepts related to what particular funding source would be and questions related to how it would affect them and their interests. And so getting hung up on the number seems less important. But related to that, what Kate said at Pledge Council, it seemed like Kenji reflected, I think, in saying it's there are rationales for doing something as a percentage basis rather than a flat fee that seemed to resonate with what we heard from Pledge Council. And then I'm still wondering why not have the income tax surcharge conversation as a progressive surcharge rather than kind of a flat percent.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it seemed like there was some resonance with what we were hearing based on what Kate said around going progressive, and it may at least...
We're going to look at both.
Keep a... okay, so I just want to... I'm just wanting to hear from the task force when we go to, or when you all go, and the extent others are involved, when the conversation happens with stakeholders, is it around the potential for an income tax surcharge that is flat or progressive, or, you know, how narrow are we trying to make it at this point?
Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I don't think we are, based upon what we've heard from the Legislative Council. I think it'd be smart to take out both concepts, flat versus percent, because she indicated that the percent may actually be more constitutionally palatable than a flat.
But we're going to ask that in writing,
yeah.
And we're going to get that
and
back for what we call
research.
The fatal flaws. Yeah.
They'll be doing more research over the next 2 weeks.
Well, another fold in it is percentage-based doesn't necessarily mean progressive as a
you're changing percent.
Okay, I hear you. Yeah. Excuse me.
I think Tricia was there first.
I'm sorry?
I think Trisha was there first.
Oh, Trisha and then Tricia.
You hit me, no.
Sorry. I'm pointing.
I have a couple of questions. I think one is just because at this point there's so much information and so many variables. Are we taking a directionally correct vote today? Because I'm there are so many nuances that we've been discussing.
We're going to take an intention vote. Well, that's what we're doing. We're trying to reach consensus on an intention vote.
Okay.
And what I see happening is the staff will work and craft that intention.
Okay.
And I'm going to get a little bit into the weeds here on the outreach. We would prepare a PowerPoint presentation that you would with one of the staff hopefully go out and present that and say, here's where we are. I mean, here's our whole background, here's where we are, and we'd like to know whether you're on board with this or there's issues with it. And then you would come back and report back to the task force at our next meeting. I would talk to my constituencies, and they're okay with this, or no, they're not okay. We got a little variation here, and then we try to bring that all together.
Okay. So there are a couple of nuances that I just wanted to make sure that there's clarity and agreement on. One is for the exemptions for low-income filers. It's not clear to me in this document that that's tied to something like earned income tax credit or okay.
Yeah, and look down on the small.
Yeah,
I am looking at the small print, but it doesn't say earned income tax credit. Okay, so that's my.
But in fairness, I want to make sure we address, because Merrill caught Tricia and I at the break, and Merrill is concerned that 20,000 is too low.
And 20,000 actually is not earned income tax credit eligibility. It's pegged to the number of children in a family. It's pegged to whether it's a single filer or a married filer. So that's, I think, what raises concern for me, that it might actually not be pegged to the earned income tax credit. So that's one concern. So that's why my concern is that we're voting on something that's directionally correct, because there are so many nuances where there are still questions before we go out and shop this around.
But I think you're right. I would agree with you. I think that's probably a single filer at the very
with no
lowest
kids,
level. Yeah,
right.
At the very lowest level, because I think there's a gradient.
There is.
So yeah.
The other thing about the bottle bill, so I agree about the percentage rather than the actual flat rate. And I was looking at how many states have a sugar sweetened beverage tax and how many have a water bottle tax, and the average of the states that do have a tax, it's somewhere in the area of 3%. So 1% to me seems to be not in inconsistent with what's happening with states that are adding similar taxes. So we might also want to think about that, just so that there's a level of consistency, because a number of other states have also passed that, and a number of those also have the bottle deposit too. So if there's any question about adding the tax on top of the deposit, we wouldn't be the first or the only to do that either.
Bruce?
Yeah, and I just wanted to briefly, in our group, we did get into a few of the nuances around the surtax versus the surcharge. And one of the concerns about the surtax, the percentage-based thing there, is that at a certain point fairly quickly, higher-income taxpayers, their accountants will say, just go buy a fishing license. You're going to save yourself $500. So it creates some complications there. Those are things that could be addressed in the construction of the...
That's the point of it. When I proposed it, Bruce, that was the actual point, to incentivize people to buy fishing or hunting licenses, which then would presumably generate more federal dollars.
No, and we do want to incentivize people, but if you're going to trying to make it progressive, letting the wealthiest people in the state off the hook is not necessarily the good thing. But what I was going to say is there's ways to write legislation to do that. So if we were going the legislative route, that's probably something that could be addressed. If you were trying to sell this in a ballot measure, that would be really hard to explain to people how to make that thing work. So we were kind of back and forth. It sort of depends. And my personal opinion is the legislature's not going to actually pass any of these things. And you have your choice whether you want to the bottlers and beverage industry to kill you in the legislature, or you want to face that constituency of several million income taxpayers.
Well, it is interesting, and I agree with all that, but I was just running some numbers, and it if anybody really sits down and does the math on buying bottled beverages, it actually hits lower-income people much harder than it does higher-income people, you know, as a percentage. I mean, if you want to be progressive about it, bottle tax is not the way to go. Or a beverage tax, because there's no question it'll hit low-income people as a percentage much much harder than any kind of a surtax would.
Okay, so. Scott?
I think that our conversation here leads into one of my bigger concerns, in that I think it's great that we're going to go talk to stakeholders, but I think it's critical that we create like a one-page document that we all use as a base, and we delineate some of the stuff, because if we all have different messaging, it's going to be a nightmare out there.
So we're going to get to that in just a minute, how we're going to craft that. But let's summarize, Jim, what you think you heard from the task force, and then we'll see if we got everybody on the same page. You can live with it. You may not totally agree, but you can live with it. So let's summarize what you think you heard. I want to make sure we get that on the record there.
So to implement the objectives we've identified, and I will all them right now. Task force understands we need to generate approximately $80 million a biennium. We've looked at a variety of funding scenarios. We have two that we're exploring in detail at this point. One is a tax return surcharge. And we're looking at two nuances there. One is a flat tax with a couple exemptions. The other would be a percentage surtax. And I don't think we need to really talk about, I agree with Brett, we don't have to be specific about, it would be a flat tax of $20. We can use, if queried, we could say, well, we're looking at $20 maybe. But whatever.
But at least conceptually, that's what we're thinking about. Okay, cards
and
up.
Then the second one.
Oops, sorry.
Is there, I got ahead of myself. A beverage container tax, right. And we're looking at both an amount per bottle, per container, or a percentage. We're exploring both of those.
That would create $80 million.
Yeah, that creates $80 million.
Additional. Okay, cards up.
We're voting for both.
Yes. Yep. Okay. Nancy and Mike, we've got all green cards here.
No pressure.
I'm green.
Nancy?
You know, I did not get most of that. It cut out. So I'm just going to abstain and let you
okay.
go forward.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay. So now let's talk about the outreach. So we need to make sure, you know, I don't know if you listened to Bill Clinton speak last night. I thought he made a really good point when he said it's really easy to give a speech it's really hard to provide leadership. It's really hard to do the work that the senator does, and that's the hard part. And so now, you know, it's really easy just to talk to people, but we're making really tough, hard decisions that are going to be challenged, and we got to work that to make sure that when we do go into the legislature, that we have our act together and that we have done our homework with our constituencies. So when we're in front of Senator Edwards' committee and he says, well, what do the lobbyists think of this, or what do the public think of this, we can say, well, they're sitting right behind us and they're going to come up and tell you what they think, and they support this or don't support this or whatever. And so part of that is the outreach that we would go to our constituents and ask, you know, are you okay with this? Would you be willing to support this? And so what we would do is staff would prepare likely just a PowerPoint, a short PowerPoint and a handout, and we would ask that, and this is the idea, is that either myself or Jim would go with you to your various groups, and because you know your groups, we don't, and we would present the proposal and get their input back, pro or con, on that idea. That would be the strategy, and we would try to do that before our next meeting in August. That's the thinking. Thoughts on that? Everybody okay with that? Yeah, Rob?
Well, we have a lot of constituents, and I'm not sure there's time.
We would have to pick...
for everyone.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to get everybody, but the key ones that we would see that we think would carry some weight. Yeah, we're not going to get to everybody. But, you know, I'm thinking of Association of Oregon Industries, Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, from my perspective, at least where the groups that I work with. So, okay, I see all head nodding here. No?
I think it's awfully ambitious.
Yeah, it is ambitious.
By the next meeting.
Yeah. But at least we could get a perspective, and then we could, in September, maybe we could still do some more in September prior to the legislative hearings, which are toward the end of September. Senator.
I think it's – so for – I want to preface – actually, it's not a preface to my previous comments because it's after the fact, so I'm not – a postscript, if you will. Just by themselves, any of these revenue things are just, they're just tough issues to take on in the legislature. They're going to be tough with stakeholders in the Capitol. They're going to be tough with constituencies. So one, the legislature needs to understand what this does, what the Oregon conservation strategy is. I can guarantee that the legislature does not understand what the Oregon conservation strategy is, number one. Okay, so you're asking them to take a tough vote on something that they don't understand.
Just like every day.
To fund something that they don't understand. Number two, so that is going to be critical. Secondly, to the extent that the Oregon conservation strategy pokes different stakeholders in the eye. I mean, there are plenty of stakeholders that probably don't want the Oregon Conservation Strategy funded. You know, maybe they're not in this room right here for a reason. But that doesn't mean, though, that they don't have a lot of influence in the legislature. So that is something to keep in mind as well. But then thirdly, the ray of hope is that, you know, if you were able to put together a coalition, you know, that it includes cities and counties and the Sierra Club and the Oregon Hunters Association and the fish groups and maybe even some natural resource groups. I don't know where Pacific Seafood would be on this, but, you know, they have a lobbyist that's running around the building during the legislative session. And I don't know where the utilities would end up being. I don't know how this affects them and how the Oregon conservation strategy affects them, but and where they would end up being. But Nike, Columbia Sportswear, Nature Conservancy. I mean, there are a lot of really influential groups that can be a part of this. that could get the legislature's attention, I believe, long enough to understand the conservation strategy and whether the juice is worth the squeeze.
So your point is pick the right groups.
So, well, you're going to have to, I mean, and then, and I don't know, you know, there are a lot of natural resource groups that I've never taken the time myself to talk with them about the Oregon conservation strategy. I don't know what the cattlemen think about it. You know, I don't know what the Farm Bureau thinks about it, or the Oregon Forest Industries Council, to name just a few, the dairy farmers.
Beverage industry.
You know, I don't know what they think about the Oregon conservation strategy and what that means for them and what risks they see that being, or maybe there's some potential benefit, particularly as the agency starts to charge more and pass on costs in some of their permitting activities and stuff, which is going to start happening. So it's a dynamic area. I wanted to leave some hope on the table for you for all the work that you put in, because there is potential to bring together a really broad coalition and get some attention to this. And that will have to happen for these difficult votes to have a chance. So,
Mike?
Listening to Senator Edwards talk about the Oregon conservation strategy reminded me that that particular turn of phrase is intimidating and off-putting for an awful lot of particularly outdoor sport-oriented people. Because in most cases, the word conservation results in restriction or reduction of opportunity. So in putting our sales information together, I would urge the agency to figure out another way to frame the description of the Oregon conservation policy. I mean, we know what it is. It is the guiding handbook by which the agency operates, okay? But a lot of people just don't understand it on those terms. They understand that to say that's the way that they're going to keep us from doing what we want to do. So just as a practical matter, I think we need to frame the language in a way that's more user-friendly, okay? Oregon conservation strategy is not a friendly turn of words for a lot of outdoors enthusiasts.
Okay, thank you. Claire, and then Jim.
I would agree. I think when we frame this, I mean, to most people, even if it's a web-based document, it still is a plan, it's a document, and I think that if there's ways of describing what it intends to accomplish, that would be helpful. My main point, though, is a question for the department. You know, when this document was originally developed, and as you've been updating it recently, what kind of coalitions have you built? What kind of groups were there to support it? Since I understand it had a lot of support. Does this kind of support still exist? Have you been working with these groups that we could build on?
Yeah, and Kevin can certainly speak in more detail, but we worked with and consulted with probably 200 different groups and individuals and contacts on this particular update and on the original plan. So there has been a lot of involvement from a wide variety of stakeholders on this particular update, on the original plan and the update. And you know, multiple opportunities for public to comment, and many groups came and supported it when it was adopted by the commission back a year ago. So there has been a lot of involvement, which is part of the reason why we thought it made sense to kind of use as a building point for this conversation about what the department or what could be done to move Oregon forward to address natural resource issues in the future, because it was a document that was developed with a lot of input and a lot of different stakeholders. Table.
Okay, Jim?
Well, I do think it's very important for us to try to reach those five big communities, and we're not going to be able to reach every single organization in them. So what we got to try to do is reach the influencers. And in a nutshell, what we're going to ask them is, do you understand there's a big problem? Do you understand we need a big solution? Do you like one of the better of these alternatives better? And would you be willing to support politically this effort moving forward? And that's what we need to do, the finger pulse check on pretty darn quick, because by the end of August, we're going to be narrowing We're going to be narrowing our choice, and we're going to be preparing our language to go to the legislature, and we're going to be bouncing right out to broader cross-sections of those communities to say, okay, now, these legislators are going to be checking with you. They're going to be checking with your lobbyists, see if this thing has a kind of coalition strength that Senator Edwards was talking about, or if this thing is a flash in the pan and everybody's got three criticisms of it, which means it won't go anywhere. And so I would say working on our language, working on our message, and reaching out to them and getting a quick pulse check is really important so that we make the right strategic decisions in August and we make the adjustments in how we talk about the plan and what's in the plan and what our proposal is before we submit it to the legislature on the 16th. Of course it won't be perfect, but if everybody of those five major communities, their lights are just blinking red the whole way, we got big trouble. Because the legislature's not gonna wanna do this. The only reason they're gonna do it is because there's a broad coalition saying, if you don't do this, we'll go to an initiative. Frankly, that's the only thing that's capable of mounting enough push that they would actually do something approaching what we want. We gotta know whether those lights are blinking green, those lights are blinking red, or whether they're half all over the place and modifying the proposal would make it better, or anything we deliver is dead on arrival. We just need to know that pretty quick in terms of how we prepare ourselves to go with our first legislative. The second thing is I'm assuming, and you guys bounce this back to me if I'm wrong, that we're not going to the media, that we're kind of being quiet, we're being kind of low-key, that our first outreach to the media will be as we make our public presentation in September. This is the time when we ask our friends and our partners what they think about this, but we're not being high profile.
Yeah, we don't have a decision yet. We don't have a decision yet to go to the media with.
People could go to the media and say the same sort of conversation. I'm just assuming we don't want to do that strategically. Mm.
So
I'm going to do a check and see if you agreed.
Yeah. Joe, do you remember what this bill passed by, 2402? What was the vote? Okay, so it passed pretty handily. I mean, so my point is we're doing what the legislature asked us to do. And they knew it was going to be tough, but we're doing what the legislature asked us to do. We're proposing some long-term sustainable funding sources. So, I mean, that's our mission. That's what we're doing. We're doing their request, and so we're going to try to do the best job we can. So, and we're going to it's going to be tough. Yeah, we all know that. Okay, so in summary, Kenji.
Yep. So I'm going to echo Mike in terms of the language makes a difference, and there was a specific purpose for naming the bottle proposal the Outdoor Preservation Enhancement Fund. Wording is key. And also, one of the things that we should definitely be discussing with some of the interest groups are the potential upsides. Even though they might be impacted by some negative financials, there are potential marketing upsides, selling to especially the general public, some goodwill that could be generated. So make sure that that's tapped into, too.
Okay. So in summary, we'll put together a one-pager, and we'll also develop a short PowerPoint presentation. We'll get a list of who we think are the key. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you?
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
And we'll develop a list of the key stakeholders, and then we will take it on a little bit of a roadshow and see what we get. So, yeah, you were going to share that with.
So two thoughts. So this really isn't about the Oregon Conservation Strategy. That's just a tool for defining what the conservation objectives are. If we go back to the purpose of the legislation, is how do we enhance hunting and fishing opportunities and access the outdoors and meet our conservation obligations through alternative funding sources? We will be very careful about using the terms Oregon Conservation Strategy because, again, it's just a vehicle for defining the objectives.
Yeah, if I could our main job is to identify and recommend potential alternative sustainable funding sources for the State Department of Fish and Wildlife that are consistent with the intent and purpose of the mission of the department. That's what the bill says.
And
that's what we're doing.
We can't keep funding through license fees or expand access to these resources through our current methods. So we need new funding. So before you leave today, or you're going to get this from me anyway via email, I'm going to ask for a quick turnaround. We're asking you to help us identify what are the organizations that we should be hitting over the next 6 weeks, who the contact people are for those organizations. Are you willing to make that contact? Please say yes. And participate in a briefing with that individual or that organization.
About to have just individual meetings or group meetings with multiple individuals, or is there any
However it plays.
Yeah.
So, you know, group meetings would be perfect. Yeah, we understand, you know, how challenging that can be at this time of year. But
I see the Farm Bureau in the back of the meeting, so I'm going to be talking to them immediately, see if I can get on their agenda.
So we created a form that we can start compiling this so that we can start getting it scheduled. So either fill this out today or I'll email it to you and you send it right back to me.
Jim?
What I'd offer a suggestion, I'm already thinking about what we're going to do to reach the sport fishing groups. I'm thinking about inviting the leaders, the executive director and maybe the board chair of five or six of the key organizations to that meeting. It's just like our discussion group, and just give them a quick briefing. You know, so and then assuming that they'll go back to their group and talk about it. So rather than choosing one organization, I would encourage you, to the extent you have any existing process, like maybe the board of the Oregon Outdoor Industries Council, Oregon Caucus, you know, that kind, those kind of combinations, so you reach as many organizations as possible, so that if they go back and talk about it and their flag goes up, boom, they're going to call you up and say, ooh, four of our organizations think it's a great idea, two think it's dumb. You know, that's what we really need, is that quick turnaround. So I would encourage us maybe to think, if in your different sectors those kind of mechanisms exist, invite them.
And I would hopefully, that you can't force this by any means, but if you could let Jim or I know, and we would try everything possible to join you so that we can help, because you're singing to the choir in some cases to your own group, and we could be there to.
And I think that's really important, so we have a consistent message.
Yeah.
Because you'll be participating in a bunch of them. You'll be listening to a bunch of them from different perspectives. We might not hear it. We're so used to working with them.
I committed Jim. I shouldn't have done that. So, I'll commit myself, but I can't commit Jim.
Well, we have staff here. Yeah. Candidly speaking, we'll leave Roger at home just so it's not perceived to be an ODF&W exercise.
Yeah, probably not have Roger.
But
because it's a legislative task force, not a department task force.
Yeah, okay. These are not conversations where we're asking somebody for their logo on a piece of paper or for an endorsement. These are conversations about, here's where we are, here's where the thinking is of the task force. What do you think in response?
Yeah.
Are we steering in the right direction?
Positives, and it's framed in, I think, with the one pager that you've all asked for, bullet points on why this matters. I mean, why what we're proposing to do actually matters, and the conversation with them is, why does it matter to them, to their interests, whether it's a business or whether it's a landowner who doesn't want to see additional species of those things, or whether it's a recreational biking community, something like that.
And we would anticipate these are relatively short conversations, 20 to 30 minutes at the most.
Okay, done with that?
How soon would we anticipate getting this
soon.
Something to take out, because...
Pretty quick, but first tell us who you're going to go meet with.
So you've got that sheet you can pass around.
Email that to us.
Yeah, we'll email this to you.
Okay.
Paul will have that.
So our next meeting.
Probably early next week.
Early next week.
Our next meeting is scheduled for August 15th. Are we good with that, or do you want to push it out? It's not very far away. It's only, two and a half weeks.
One thought about August 15th is, so we've asked for Legislative Council to give us some more input on the surcharge, and she said that would take a couple of weeks. We would have that piece of information. If you meet on the 15th, I suspect it's not a full-day meeting, because there isn't much else at this point in time that we'd be prepared to bring to you, because we'll be concentrating on this outreach.
So 9 to noon, you're thinking? Okay, so if you can make August 15th, great. If you can't, we understand.
I'm assuming that if we've heard something dramatic by August 15th, we're going to start working on our proposal. We may not have crossed all our...
Yeah, we'd
all our eyes, but if there's a whole bunch of red lights blinking, it's time to talk about it.
Well, I was hoping that August 15th, we would actually have some reports back from some of the meetings we've already had and say, what are you hearing?
What I'm assuming.
Does the road need to be turned, or are we on the right path? Where are we headed?
And I'm just a flag. You all were appointed by the governor because bring something to the table. And there's an assumption. Yes, I think everything is right about what's been said about the need for more outreach and engagement and the challenge in pushing this up a hill. But I think implicit in the appointment is that you all have relationships and people respect you in your various communities. And we don't know exactly what various communities are going to say in response, but I think just don't doubt your ability to stand behind what you've represented as where you want to go in this work group, and recognize that at least at the governor's level, she's assumed that your voice is going to carry some weight with people in the communities out there. So even though this is a big task, let's not sell ourselves short. It's a good group of people here.
Okay. We're going to go to public comment unless there's anything else to come before us. So, okay, we'll open it up to public comment. Anybody has any public comment they would like to say? Yes.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. Thank you very much. I've been listening carefully and trying to follow the work that you've been doing. I worked on 2402 that helped you get here. I just wanted to share one observation, and I certainly agree with Senator Edwards. It's going to be an uphill battle no matter what you choose. And there are some measures on the November ballot that will also affect this discussion, both the corporate excise tax, but also the outdoor school issue. Those are two of them that are on the agenda. So those will be interesting as you move forward. It will not affect your September report. But the other thing I wanted to remind you all is that when the 15% for parks and OWEB, water enhancement, the salmon plan, let's do it that way, occurred, there was general fund money for parks in the budget. As soon as we passed that lottery money, that general fund disappeared. It was not the intent when the 15% lottery dollars was enacted. The idea was that it was to enhance and to make sure that we had the maintenance in parks and that the salmon plan could move forward. So what I also heard you say this afternoon is that you're sort of counting on the $30 million of general fund that took blood, sweat, and tears in 2015 to get, because I don't believe that you had even that before. So I just want to let you know that there are some history things and some concerns. The League really cares very deeply about the Oregon Conservation Strategy and the fact that we need to move forward, both to make sure that we don't have additional increases in hunting and fishing licenses, we have hunters and fishers in our groups, but also to make sure that we have a full conservation vision in Oregon. So it's not that we're not supportive of what you're doing, but I just wanted to bring those little minor issues up. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Yep, totally understand what sweeping is. So. Anybody else?
Me.
Yep.
Nanette Jones. I feel that it's very important that these different agencies, like Senator Whitsett brought up, are able to work together. because we're spending a lot of money on the Oregon conservation strategy, or we're hoping to. Yet when we have the Oregon Department of Forestry contracting out with timber companies to come in and clear cut marble murrelet habitat, how does that fit into the conservation strategy? And how will that connect Oregonians with the outdoors? How does spring glyphosate all over our Clatsop County basically protect our fish? We're spending a lot of money asking people to spend money on protecting the fish when we have other agencies that aren't all on the same page. So I think it's important that we reach out and that we are able to have a unified goal for conservation strategy across Oregon, because it seems like right now agencies are all doing their own thing, and really the wildlife, they're not benefiting, you know? I mean, we could do a lot better. And one thing would just be stop the aerial spraying of glyphosate and clear cutting. Can we do that? That would be conserving and a good strategy.
Okay, thank you, Nanette.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Yep, come on up.
I'll try to be brief here. Adam Meyer, OCN. Thanks all of you for your work. I really appreciate, and I know a lot of people here really appreciate. It's not an easy issue, and you guys are spending a lot of good time on it, so thank you. Just wanted to make a couple quick points. As Peggy mentioned, there are some other things up on the ballot coming up here. Transportation is going to be a big issue in the coming session. There might be some money needed for that. There are going to be a lot of kind of competing needs for revenue and for money. And I think that with that in mind, it's going to be difficult for legislators to be looking at enacting new funds for this. I think it's important not to push for it now, but to come up and have a conversation with what it looks like to continue this conversation if it doesn't move forward in this next legislative session. There should be a longer term strategy as well if it can't get pushed through this session. I think that's really important. I also think that when we're talking about moving ideas forward, it's really important to look at other agencies. There are a number of other natural resource agencies that could be involved in this discussion, I think should be involved in this discussion, whether it's water resources that's having some needs, DEQ, Department of Forestry. There are a number of agencies that are also having funding challenges. They just announced today a $220.8 million price tag on the Elliott State Forest. So there's a lot of issues out there that are all converging right now that could be taken into account, and those agencies could bring power or political power to the table. And I know legislators would probably love to solve multiple challenges at the same time if there's some way to do that. So maybe just think about those items. And again, thank you for your work.
Okay, thank you very much. Anybody else? Okay, we'll see you on the 15th. We're adjourned at 4:05. Five after four.